today on BPR from the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Congressman Joe Kennedy has railed against Trump Care. Yesterday, it passed the House. We'll get his thoughts, then yours. Then it's food guy Corby Cummer on organic milk that isn't, school lunches that aren't healthy, and chickens that aren't rushed to slaughter. At noon, it's Emily Rooney with her famous list of fixations and fulminations.
Two legends in a row, singer-songwriter Tom Rush. We are so excited. He's going to serenade us live right here at the Boston Public Library. Then legendary documentary filmmaker Fred Wiseman, creator of Titicut Follies. He has a new retrospective at the MFA. Boston Globe columnist Shirley Young will tell us whether Ivanka Trump, whose new book, Women Who Work, just hit the stores, is the new feminist icon, God help us. And our Friday news quiz with the folks from Peerless, a fantastic new play about high school kids' nefarious schemes to get into college.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, and we are broadcasting live from our studio, the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
By the way, welcome. I'm not laughing at you, but I know you so well.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you and your dog are having a great day and a half off. You're totally relaxed. Then all of a sudden, at about 3 o'clock yesterday, you click on CNN and you start vibrating around your house. Is that a safe assumption?
Let me tell you something. Even my dog was weeping. He had little tears coming down his little eyes. He's very upset about his fellow Americans.
So in any case, as you I'm sure know, the Republicans managed to resuscitate their health care bill, getting it through the House with a margin of 217 to 213. No Democrats, 20 Republicans voted no. Throughout their mission to repeal Obamacare, Congressman Joe Kennedy has been a vocal and consistent critic of Trump Care. He's also been a persistent defender of Obamacare while calling for reforms that would make health care more accessible, more affordable, and cover more people. He joins us now. Congressman, thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me. And Marjorie, it was a tough day for me yesterday, too, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. No fun.
Yeah, well, as I said, and I'll say it again, I think a lot of us, you know, turned on the television and we saw people cheering, the Republican House members cheering, going to the White House, big celebration with President Trump. And I'm thinking to myself, millions of people are in jeopardy here, could lose their health care. These are your colleagues that you speak with at least sometimes at work every day, and led by House Speaker Ryan, and I'm struck that he talks a lot about being a Catholic, and it seems to me that the people that are losing here are the very poorest and most needy Americans. So what do these guys think about this? Do they really think this is good, or is this all about getting rid of Obamacare, you know, which has been a rallying cry for the last 7 years?
Look, I think you guys know politics well, and sometimes the inexplicable happens. I struggle to understand how anybody could define success as taking away health care from 24 million people. I think that somehow it is a good day in our nation when the sick and the suffering and the elderly, you rip health care or access to health care out from underneath their feet. And that's what this bill does. They know it, and they voted for it anyway. I think, look, you can tell how proud folks are of a bill by the way they're willing to stand behind it and the way that they pass it. This was a bill that was hobbled together by a political compromise between different factions of the Republican Party that was then put on the floor with less than 24 hours notice without any sort of independent analysis as to what it's going to do to our country. Earlier versions of it indicate, yes, 24 million people will lose access to care over the course of the next decade, $880 billion cut from Medicaid. And that's not just health care for the poor. That's long-term care. That's behavioral mental health services. That's half of all the births in our country are paid for by Medicaid. Special education funding in schools comes through Medicaid as well. So it has huge and drastic consequences on the fabric of our society. And, you know, I think many of our Republican colleagues just felt like this was a promise, that a campaign promise that they had made and that they had to do it. You talk to some of them, and this has been reported in the press, and they said that they couldn't pass this by one vote because then every single member would be the reason why it passed, and they needed it to pass by two. And you know how many it passed by?
Two
people. So it just smells of politics through and through. doctors were against this, hospitals were against this, insurers were against this, the faith community was against this, nurses were against this, seniors were against this, patients were against this, every single group that had something at stake in healthcare said this was a bad deal and it's bad policy, and it passed anyway. So trying to explain that is difficult, and trying to explain the idea that you're going to have a go have a party after taking away healthcare from folks, I'm not sure I can justify that.
You know, the only group I know, Joe Kennedy, who supported were sadists of America, I believe, was it. You know, Congressman, I hadn't thought about this until I was reading it yesterday. You know, 17% approval for the first version of this, which failed. And obviously, it is crueler to real people, allowing states to get these waivers so they don't have to cover people with pre-existing conditions, at least charge the same rates. They don't need the policies to be as comprehensive. The floor is lower, et cetera. Is there not an incentive, assuming we know it still has to go to the Senate, we'll talk about that in a minute. Is there not an incentive, if the bill were to become law as passed yesterday by your colleagues, for some companies to move to states that do get those waivers so they can provide less coverage to their employees and spend less to hire these people?
I think there absolutely is. And there's been press reports on that already. Which is, again, one of the consequences of trying to rush this bill through before most members of Congress, let alone the American public, understand what's in it, is you end up creating incentives, and they're, again, public reporting even this morning, indicating that some employers, right, so employer-based healthcare, might shift the way that they provide coverage for their employees. And that is something that I think is going to come as a shock to most folks who thought, hey, you know, I get good healthcare from my employer, I don't need to do this. I don't need to worry about this. Turns out you do, because of a little-known clause inserted in that bill that didn't get proper vetting before it passed. So I think, you know, there's an awful lot of lessons here about how not to pass legislation. And if you're proud of a bill that you're willing to take it to the American public and defend it and debate it and stand behind it, and they didn't do that. And it's ultimately the American public that's going to pay the price for it. So, look, this fight is not over, as you said, Jim, and it's still got a long way to go through the Senate. I don't discount for a second, though, that the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, is going to find a way to get some bill out of the Senate. It's up to our senators and the writ large across our country. And I know Senator Markey and Warren will be huge fighters in this. But and it's up to the American public to demand that pre-existing conditions are covered, period. To demand that we're looking at finding ways to make access to quality, affordable care easier across the nation rather than harder. And that isn't just a price tag. That means that you fight to make sure that insurance actually means something. And the idea that somehow, Jim, really what this bill does is it separates the healthy from the elderly, the sick, and the frail. And says, if you're healthy, pay for it on your own. You will get cheaper care. But for those in need of care, you literally are now on your own and are going to have to somehow bear the burden of that cost without hardly any protection put in place. And that fundamentally isn't what healthcare is about. It isn't what insurance is. It's literally the definition of it. And it's not who we are as a country.
Congressman, if this bill is as we expect, it will be moderated considerably in the Senate. And you just said Mitch McConnell would get something through, but I would think it's going to not look like what, at least I hope it's not going to look like what just came out of the House. So then the Senate gets their bill. Does the Freedom Caucus, and those are the people that are the most conservative that had to be kind of dragged into agreeing to this bill by some changes made to it, will they go along with a moderation in the Senate, or will they stop the whole thing and go back to square one? What do you expect will happen after the Senate?
Marjorie, I'm not quite as optimistic as you are about the quality of the bill that will come out of the Senate. Remember, the Senate can only lose two votes, and you've got three hardline Republicans between Senator Cruz, Senator Lee, and Rand Paul that have indicated that if this isn't a bill that mirrors what the compromise that's come out of the House, that they're not going to vote for it, which is enough to sink it. So Mitch McConnell's got a very delicate balancing act that he's going to have to try to maneuver through. And I don't doubt for a second that he's capable of doing so, but I think that bill, I hope that it's moderated a bit. It can't moderate all that much. So The only way that this does moderate significantly is if American public in some of those key states end up raising their voices and demanding, you know, that Senators Portman and Corker and Murkowski and Collins and Cassidy and Gardner and a whole bunch of other ones don't cave in to those three. And if it does come out of the Senate, which I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what that's going to look like, but there's going to be a real question as to whether it gets through back through the House. But, I mean, again, this is something that as of 6 weeks ago, I expected it to pass then. I was wrong, but I expected it to pass last week, and I was wrong. But I did expect it would pass. And I think we're playing a very, very dangerous game now with the erosion of critical protections around how Americans access their health care system.
Congressman Kennedy, one last question for me, if I may. Is this kind of legislating, no scoring, as it's called by the Congressional Budget Office, no Democratic votes or attempts to get them, not exactly concerned about the impact on the American people. Is this going to be an aberration relating to the Obamacare issue because this was their central pledge, the Republicans and Donald Trump? Or do you see this as symptomatic of what lies ahead with things like tax reform, infrastructure, that this is the way things are going to proceed?
I'm fearful that, Jim, you're 100% right. I mean, look, I think we've heard from Republicans, from Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, while they were taking power and beforehand, about the importance of the strength of our institutions in the Senate and the integrity in the House and the integrity of both. We then saw Mitch McConnell erode and destroy decades of Senate precedent and lower the filibuster majority in order to confirm the Supreme Court justice. We have heard the clips of Paul Ryan have gone around and promises that they made even beginning this year that any bill that comes to the floor would be readable for 3 days, which, by the way, is basically a 24-hour notice, but would certainly have a CBO score. This one didn't, so there's no independent analysis as to what its impact is going to be across the country. We have heard principles that the Republicans in the House have tried to put forth about tax reform, that it should be paid for, even if there's going to be a reduction in taxes. And then the president of the United States came out with, by some estimates, a $7 trillion tax cut that doesn't need to be paid for. They've set up these processes, and there's some protections in these processes, but through reconciliation, where they don't need a single Democratic vote, and then have tried to blame Democrats for not voting for a legislation that was never set up to engage Democrats to begin with. And so I think I'm not sure how authentic that those promises really are, how genuine they are, when if they can't get what they want doing it the way they want to do it, Republicans will just fall back and do what they can by manipulating the rules and forcing things through without the public understanding the consequences of them. And look, that has not only is that scary, not only is that bad governance, that has huge impacts for the American people on issues like taxes and the incentives in our economy and healthcare, which is extraordinarily personal. And, you know, I think if you were proud of this bill, if you believed in it, if you were willing to stand behind it, you had no problem in pressing pause for a day so that the American public could read it, going back to your districts over the course of this next recess period, engaging in those town halls, explaining it to your voters and your constituents, standing behind it and then voting for it in 2 weeks. They didn't do that. According to public reports, Jim, there are 7 members of the Republican Party who voted for this bill that have scheduled town halls next week. 7 out of 217. That should tell you something.
Joe Kennedy, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Congressman. Very much.
Appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, we certainly do, too. Thank you. Congressman Joe Kennedy represents the 4th District of Massachusetts. Thank you again. Coming up, we're opening up the lines and asking you about the GOP's bill. Hopeful that you don't have pre-existing conditions.
Why am I laughing?
Anyway, that is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you just tuned in, we were talking to Congressman Joe Kennedy about the GOP's health care bill passed yesterday. If it makes it through the Senate, what could it mean for Massachusetts? Now we want to get your take on this. And by the way, specifically, if you voted for Donald Trump, is this what you voted for? A health care bill that cuts Medicaid, slashes insurance subsidies, and likely guts protections for people with pre-existing conditions. The number is 877-301-8970. Or do you believe this is exactly what Congress should have done and that what Obamacare needed? You know, there's a great piece. Andy Barowitz, who's our favorite blogger, I guess you can say, has a great piece. Says, moments after House Republicans voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act on Thursday, millions of Trump supporters celebrated the imminent loss of their health insurance. Quote, ever since President Trump was inaugurated, I've been counting the days for him to take away my health insurance. Carol Feuler said, today I just want to thank you, Mr. President, for keeping your promise. And then Harlan Dorenson, a Trump voter from Florida, says, I just hope the Senate doesn't come in and give me back my health coverage. Right now, all this feels too good to be true. You know, as satirical as that is, it's not ridiculous. The original bill that failed had 17% approval. 17% approval from the American people, yet they have made it worse. I mean, worse for real people. The pre-existing condition thing, where states can get waivers. The minimum coverage breadth from which the states can get waivers. On top of all the crap, if you'll excuse the expression, that was in the original bill that caused only 17% to support it. It is almost surreal.
You know, and people forget that before Obamacare, which has a lot of problems, and if I were, you know, a political leader, my goal would be to fix the problems with Obamacare. Mm-hmm. But we can't fix the problems with Obamacare because that would be giving some credit to Obamacare, so we have to, like, grind that into
the
ground.
But that's the Democrats' fault. If they really wanted to fix the thing, as they say they did, they should have done it before.
They absolutely.
So many people thought it was okay to essentially cut the heart out.
Well, I think we didn't know how many problems it had for many months when it was first rolled out, and there was all that confusion about the website, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is just unbelievable. It is what we're doing yet again is giving this massive tax break to the wealthiest Americans and shafting old people, people with pre-existing conditions, people, children, you know, women. I mean, it's just incredible. So I'm hoping that Congressman Kennedy is wrong and that the Senate, where saner heads are located, I hope, will really go from the beginning and protect people. Because, you know, before 2009, people forget, the major cause of bankruptcy in the United States of America was medical bills from people who had insurance.
That's correct.
And one of the things that Obama got in such trouble for saying everybody can keep their doctor, the reason everybody couldn't keep their doctor is because people had these insurance plans that didn't cover you. They were cheap, but they covered you for almost nothing. So Obamacare said you have to have basic coverage in your insurance. You know, it can't just be if you get run over by an 18-wheeler.
We don't have to worry about that anymore.
Right. So that's the thing. And they could have, again, tried to fix it. And,
can I tell you something?
I
don't want to criticize you because you just got back from 2 days vacation, but you're being a little unfair.
Okay.
One provision you haven't mentioned at all, which could be a help to people, while they do allow, Obamacare allowed older people to be charged three times as much in premiums, this allows five times as much. The provision no one is talking about, which I think is quite kind, is they'll provide the adult children of really older parents with ice blocks. They can put their parent on an ice block and just push it out to sea. 877-301-8970. We want to hear from everybody, but particularly if you're a Trump voter, is this what you thought you were getting when you voted for Donald Trump on November 8th?
And people should be, I don't think I'm going to be too strong in saying this. The president's lying. This is not going to make premiums cheaper and deductibles lower unless you happen to be.
Well, that is not true. If you're young and healthy.
Well, I didn't get it. Okay. Unless you are young and healthy.
Well, so it's
and
true.
Fairly wealthy, too. I mean, so he's not telling the truth. Paul Ryan is not telling the truth. They're trying to pretend this is something it isn't. Here's a great email from Tom. He says, does this mean the Obama death squads will be renamed the Ryan Reapers?
Dan and JP, you're first on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Welcome. Thanks.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
I guess we're fine. Hi.
I'm not fine.
Why?
Between the vote yesterday and the Rose Garden celebration, my cardiologist called and said I'm likely going to have open heart surgery, which will be my second.
Is that true?
That's absolutely true.
What's your insurance like, Cleve?
I have good
Dan,
insurance.
Dan, we call him.
Oh, it's Dan. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Dan. Go ahead.
Not a problem. I work for Salem State, so I have good state insurance. So that's not a problem for me. But every time there's a situation like this, I get freaked out because people like me, like Jimmy Kimmel's baby, I have the exact same condition. You know, if I didn't have insurance or if I had a lapse in my insurance, you know, I would have been dead 20 years ago, or I wouldn't get the care I need now.
Well, you know, Dan, it would be great if all 217 members of Congress who voted for this thing yesterday had to respond to your phone call. And we're glad you made it, and we're glad people got to hear from you, and wish you the best of luck. You know, he mentioned Jimmy Kimmel. I don't know if you were listening yesterday when you were off.
Jimmy Kimmel was great.
Stephen Colbert's, I thought, and I love Stephen Colbert, disgusting monologue about Donald Trump. I thought it was really crossing the line.
He went over the top.
On the other end of the spectrum, you have Jimmy Kimmel talking about his baby with this heart condition, a pre-existing condition, was so moving and so beautiful.
If you're a person that's not a millionaire like Jimmy Kimmel and you have that same situation, mm-hmm. you are going to run through the amount of insurance you're entitled to, presuming you can even get insurance for that pre-existing condition, and you're going to be out of luck again. So this is why there are all these bankruptcies. I mean, it is incredible. And you know what's really incredible? I hate to get carried away here.
Get carried away.
But, you know, you turn on the TV yesterday, and these guys, and it was almost all men. There were like one or two women there. Almost everybody was white. Mm-hmm. They're all up there backslapping and going up to the White House and taking selfies with Donald Trump. They're all cheering this. Well, look at people like Dan or people all around the country thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do?
You know, you've said on more than one occasion, on and off air, you're not 100% convinced the president actually knows what he's supporting.
I'm not.
I would argue here's some evidence. You know, I had a meeting yesterday. Apparently he had a makeup session with the Prime Minister of Australia, because remember they had that contentious phone call, Malcolm Turnbull. Well, here he is bashing American healthcare and praising Australian healthcare, which, by the way, just coincidentally happens to be single payer.
Single payer.
Here's the president.
Premiums are going to come down very substantially. The deductibles are going to come down. It's going to be fantastic healthcare. Right now, Obamacare is failing. We have a failing healthcare. I shouldn't say this to our great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do. But we're going to have great health care very soon.
And by the way, I'm sure you all remember during the campaign, Donald Trump supported single-payer health care and supported government picking up the tab. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Cleve in Fitchburg. Hi, Cleve. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you. What's up?
So, I'm 61 years old. Yep. I'm on Social Security disability.
Uh-huh.
I have Medicare and Medicaid. I have to go into Mass General every 10 weeks for an outpatient procedure, which costs between $2,500 and $3,000. So I'm concerned about my Medicaid coverage and how much more I'm going to have to pay.
Well, you know who's also really concerned about your Medicaid coverage? Your governor, Charlie Baker. I don't know if you heard Baker yesterday say that potentially if the House bill were to become law, and I think it's unlikely that it will become law as drafted, but if something like it became law, Massachusetts could lose $1 billion. And much of that is the change from an open-ended entitlement in Medicaid as currently exists to some sort of capping of Medicaid, which would mean there'd be less money available in many situations. I'm not sure it would affect people on Medicare, on the Social Security disability, but nevertheless, Medicaid itself would see dramatic cuts. And by the way, Cleve, since we can have one hopeful sign here, one of the reasons people like Marjorie, I tend to agree with her, think that something far less draconian is going to get through the Senate, there are at least six or seven Republican senators who come from states like Ohio. We had John Kasich on last week, Governor Kasich, who took Medicaid expansion money under Obamacare, expanded coverage to 1 million low-income people in his state. People like Senator Portman, who's from Ohio, are not going to vote for this gutting of Medicaid unless he wants to be thrown out of office. So I guess that's a sliver of hope. And Cleve, wish you luck, and thank you for the call.
Well, you know what else is hopeful, too? The American Medical Association is against this. The AARP,
everybody's against
which is
this.
Very powerful, is against this. Hospitals are against
this. So then why did it get a majority of votes in the House if they're all so powerful?
You know, the only thing I can figure out is that they're invulnerable because of gerrymandering, that they are not worried about in some of those districts. That's the only thing I can think of. Or maybe, you listen to some of these guys talk, and you think, do they realize what they've voted on? Some seem not to have realized.
Well, you know
what
the, you know what I think the hope is? You know, I've said this before in other settings. You know, when we talk about infrastructure, yeah, which both you and I are obsessed with, and I say the reason that nobody invests in infrastructure is because elected officials make a conscious or subconscious calculation. Am I going to be out of office by the time the bridge I'm not fixing right. falls down, literally or figuratively? This pre-existing conditioning, it's not like overnight all of a sudden people with pre-existing conditions are going to suffer. Maybe they think they won't be. You didn't see the poll yesterday, which would have driven you nuts. I had it on TV last night. Only 52% of Democrats and 48% of Republicans were against having states have latitude to do away with the guarantee that pre-existing conditions are covered at the same price. Only 52 and 48%. So maybe these legislators are making a calculation that people aren't going to get it. Well, and by the time they get it, they'll blame it on the Democrats.
And also that it won't be in time for the 2018 elections.
That's probably true.
Although it might be in time for the 2020 elections. But again, I don't know because, you know, women and 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Women tend to be running the health care and their family. They're worried about
that's
their
true.
Husband. They're worried about their children. People get pretty scared. When you have gotten insurance for the first time, I think the threat of this, maybe this is going to be taken away from me. Maybe I'm not going to have this. It's pretty scary to people. And by the way, the people that are really going to win on this are wealthy people, as I said, with these massive tax cuts, high-income people in general.
Tax cuts under Obama, because of Obamacare, not right. because of this tax plan that the president outlined about a week or so ago.
Yes, this is the tax cuts because Obama paid for Obamacare with taxes on the wealthy. The wealthy are not going to have to. Upper-middle-class people without pre-existing health conditions and people who wish to go without insurance, they're going to be in good shape because they're not going to have to pay any more of the fines, so they can just go to the emergency room like they used to do before Obamacare.
Debbie and Webster, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi.
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 Well, I was a Trump voter. Before uh-huh. that, I was an Obama voter. Mm-hmm. So I'm really perplexed by all of the whole political uh-huh. Things for the last 20 years. I worry about health care for many reasons. Right now, my husband and I are 59. We both work. We pay exorbitant prices for our health care mm-hmm. through the agency I work for as a social worker. I serve Medicaid people, so I'm also conflicted by that because it's like insane, and this is the best state in the country to live in, but we can't afford what we do with Medicaid already, even with Romney care. We can't afford it.
Who's we? You mean your family or the state?
No, I mean the state. We as taxpayers. I serve populations that are extremely poor, as well as really expensive, beautiful homes, and people qualify for Medicaid, MassHealth. So I am constantly conflicted.
How are wealthy people qualifying for Medicaid?
Well, let's just say this way. Two doctors own a mansion, and which is truly not the issue, but their parents live with them, and they qualify for
Medicaid. Well, yeah, with all due respect, Debbie, you're in the industry, and I'm not. I would say that's the aberration. My guess is the average Medicaid.
Debbie, there's always going to be anecdotal stuff like this. I have a whole family that works in social welfare things. There's always stories about people with the lobsters in the checkout line at wherever it is. But the point is, the guy you voted for said we were going to have better health care. It was going to be cheaper. It was going to be a fantastic plan. He has just given massive tax cuts to the people like you're worried about, the millionaires with the mansions, and shafted poor people. And I don't know how. I don't know. I mean, he's lying.
Hey, Debbie, can I ask you one last thing? We appreciate your call. If when Donald, assuming the Congressional Budget Office knows what it's talking about, that 24 million people would lose their insurance, their coverage, under the plan that failed a couple of weeks ago, and there's no reason to think this will decrease this number. If you had known that the plan that Donald Trump was going to support before November 8th would throw 24 million people, the kinds of people you serve, off Medicaid, would you still have voted for him?
Most definitely, because, again, I'm conflicted, okay? I needed a change. Obama did not help us, in my opinion.
How is throwing 24 million people... Wait. How is throwing 24 million... Debbie, how is throwing 24 million people off Medicaid, how is that a change that helps the system. How does
happy
that
with what they just did? But what I'm saying to you is, you can't look at healthcare just in one slim venue. I am hopeful that with the process of supposedly our democratic society moving forward, that it will come out to be better, and it will. Now it is an entitlement program in this country that everybody should have health care. The problem is, I am struggling to pay for mine.
I got it. Okay.
But Debbie, a couple of things that if you're getting your health care through your employer, that's not Obamacare, as you well know. And insurance costs have been going up and up and up and up and up and up and up long before Obamacare. It's a problem of are not doing anything about pharmaceutical costs, are not doing anything about insurance companies. I don't know how long you've been working, but I know that since I've been working, it's astronomical, the difference, and that was long before Obamacare. And the cost of insurance since Obamacare has had the lowest increase. It's still going up, but the lowest increase ever. So I think
not for everybody. Well, there's some states where there were huge premium increases under Obamacare.
But that's under Obamacare. I'm talking about employer-covered health insurance. If you have Blue Cross or Harvard Pilgrim, whatever through your employer, it's still going up, but it has not gone up as much.
Debbie, thank you very much for the call. Call us back in 6 months. I'm sure we'll be talking I'm curious to know what you think then.
You know what I think? I think that Obama did such a lousy job selling Obamacare. I think there's so much confusion about what it did and what it didn't do.
I think that's fair. And I think there was a huge... Yeah, I think that is fair. Let's take one more quick one, then we got to move.
Stephen Taunton. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Hi, guys. I'm still for Trump because I've told you before that I voted for him to take away the Supreme Court picks from Hillary. So that's my pick there. So anything else that he does is a icing on the cake. But I'm on Medicare. I love Medicare. All right? And I went on Medicare last year. If I hadn't gone on Medicare, we'd be really drained on our finances because I was getting killed. We went from 8 years ago having very affordable insurance to paying exorbitant prices for insurance since my wife worked for a small business. And Marjorie, the reason that premiums haven't skyrocketed as much as it did before is because insurers, employers, doubled deductibles, co-insurances, all that other stuff to keep those premiums not escalating as much as they should have. Now, my plan, my guy was Bernie on this, and I know you guys will probably drop dead on that one, but I thought that Bernie's plan, which was beaten to death by both Trump and Hillary, was the most feasible one. Like I said, I like Medicare.
And you know that Medicare is a single-payer system, which you
absolutely
know.
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
Bernie wants Medicare for all.
You know, that's and what you know. I know you are. And let me just say, Steve, the thing that drives me nuts is Medicare. It's not just you. If you look at polling, Medicare is either number one or number two in terms of the most popular things government does. Yet the exact same people, with the exception of you, who love Medicare, which is a single payer program that they love, hate the concept of single payer health care delivery for everybody else. I just don't understand it.
Because everybody calls it socialized
medicine.
That's exactly. Everybody says the government's going to run.
Steve, thanks for the call.
The government's going to run your health care and the bureaucrat is going
to
be in place.
Which is what they do to Medicare, by the way. Which is what they do with public schools, which are socialized education as well.
You know, sometimes I think we're such fools and suckers because would they have universal health care in other countries? Are people paying what we're paying?
We'll move on. We're going to do a lot on this, obviously, in the days ahead. And thank you very much for your calls.
Okay, coming up, Boston leaves the James Beard Awards empty-handed. Are we going to be known once again for our baked beans? Corby Kummer joins us for that conversation. And more, he is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. As we discussed the other day, the Trump administration is rolling back the healthy nutritional upgrades of the Obama era in schools. Award-winning food writer Corby Cummings is here to talk about this and more, including what could be the best thing since sliced bread, turning it into beer. Corby Cummings, it's great to see you.
Great to be here.
So, Corby, should we be insulted? Boston, you know, all these great restaurants running around. We kind of got snubbed in the James Beard Awards, or am I being overly dramatic?
You're being overly dramatic and sensitive. New England does well. The Northeast in the James Beard Restaurant Awards includes New York State outside of a 75-mile radius of New York City. And, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. There are and Rhode Island. There are plenty of, and Connecticut. There's plenty of places. We need the love to go around.
Okay.
And during the years I was on the committee, it's now brilliantly administered by Deborah First of the Globe. We tried very, very hard to get places in the eastern tip of Long Island, the western tip of Mass, the northeast kingdom of Vermont, and the black hole state of New Hampshire. I apologize to New Hampshire, but it is so hard to find nominees there. But we found them because that's our job. So the idea that Eventide in Maine got Outstanding Chef, it's two chefs who shared the award.
They're opening up something here, too, aren't they?
And they are in Fenway. There's going to be an Eventide Fenway. Eventide is an oyster bar and fish house in hip-happening Portland, Maine. It's great. So I think it's terrific that the regional love goes around.
We don't. Now, the James Beard Awards, for those three who don't know, sort of like the Academy Awards of food. I mean, for example, our buddy Joanne Chang won Best Baker in America, James Beard last. And Roger Berkowitz, another buddy of ours from Legal Seafood, while there was this schneid for chefs and restaurateurs, et cetera, he got one of those lifetime achievement or
it's
you're the greatest
who.
Kind of thing.
Yeah,
or?
You are the greatest. That's right.
So what did he win exactly?
Because I'm a who's who, so I'm the greatest.
You are too?
I want you to know, yeah.
You won a who's who?
Yeah, there are lots of people who get inducted into the who's who, five every year. And then we have to vote on it. It's like this scary popularity contest because there are such good people who aren't in it. So Roger Berkowitz, it tries to be trailblazers and people who do things in all aspects of the food life, not just writers, not just restaurateurs, brewers, spirits makers, humanitarians.
What did he win for? What did he win for?
Being Roger Berkowitz.
I mean,
no, for being a successful, forward-thinking restaurateur, and there are food writers who are part of it, so it's kind of everybody in the food world.
Did you vote for him?
Of course I voted for Roger. But, you know, listen, I'm not supposed to reveal my vote. Yeah.
Oh, I had a feeling you were. I knew if I asked you quickly, you would answer the question.
Don't trick me into that again.
We're talking to Corby Kummer. So I was going to say that's upbeat. Well, the Roger Berkowitz part is upbeat. The rest is not upbeat. The school lunch thing must be driving you out of your mind. We've talked about some of the great things that Michelle Obama did, from the garden at the White House to the school lunches to the whatever. Apparently through, was it Sonny Perdue, the Secretary
Sonny
of Agriculture?
Sonny Perdue.
They are pretty much undoing much of that which
That's
she
right.
did to try to make school lunches healthy.
Yes. Stuff them all with sugar and salt.
So it's especially salt and refined white grains as opposed to whole grains. So I read through the entire, because my eyes popped out of my head when I read the USDA official press release, which said, Ag Secretary Perdue moves to make school meals great again.
Yeah, exactly.
It meant it, you know, using the great again language. And what it means is rolling back provisions that require more than half of grains in school food to be whole grains. What's so ironic about this is there's all kinds of refined whole grain bread that has very little actual whole grain in it. So there's lots of ways manufacturers can make very finely milled whole grains that kids barely notice.
We were talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, about this the other day, and I said, you know, my sense is he's doing it for the industry, which obviously is very powerful in these days since November 8th, since January 20th. I said, what's their public line? And the public line of Perdue and others is kids aren't eating the healthy stuff. Mm-hmm. So even if we admit, which we don't, they don't, that we're making it a tad less healthy, it's still healthy enough, the argument would go, and they're going to eat more of it because they weren't eating that really healthy stuff that Corby Kummer loves. Is there any truth to that?
If it's not it's not nutrition if nobody eats it.
That's the classic line, right.
in the industry. But the fact is you can serve smaller portions. Not that much was being thrown away. The throw-out level was greatly exaggerated by the opponents of it. And, you know, one of the things Perdue said was there's little black flecks of whole grain grits, and I'm a Southerner because he's from Georgia. Mm. And so who wants black flecks in your grits? Well, if that's the way your grandparents say grits are, if they're grown on their farm, then you'll eat them. It's just a question of getting kids used to it. And getting kids used to lower sodium. Sodium is what I find the most pernicious and disturbing in these rollbacks.
So, but wait, stay on this for a second. Is there evidence to an objective person that kids are consuming the healthier stuff and actually liking it, not just eating it because there's no alternative? Is there that evidence or no?
Yeah. The problem is that there aren't that many studies that have been conducted of what is the throwout rate, what is the uptake rate. So people are using different data in different localities. But what's always shown is the more you serve it to kids, the more they eat it. So if they have like between 4 and 7 tastings,
yeah, I read it was
of
a 7 tasting
ingredient,
rule I read, yeah,
then they'll get used to it and they'll eat it and they'll stop complaining and they'll stop throwing it out. So this is saying, let's not even get kids used to lower sodium food, which is going to make them healthier the rest of their lives and not cost the healthcare system the outrageous fees the government will no longer pay.
You know, one of the things I saw in the story that they're no longer going to require non-fat milk, and I was kind of upset that they were requiring non-fat milk at all because I think it tastes terrible, and it doesn't really fill you up. And I thought we decided that we're going back to stopping this non-fat obsession, and we've realized that
this
fat
is true,
is a good thing.
And you are maintaining your contrarian cred.
Cheers.
By bringing up the isn't high-fat milk better? So yes, that is back on the upswing. For example, Darish Mosafarian at Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Harvard is saying, let's look at the healthful role that certain dairy fats can have in the diet. Yes, that's coming back. And the problem is that it's not just bringing back 1% milk, it's bringing back flavored milk.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
the sugar. So it's not that the problem isn't drinking plain milk or 1%. And I think 1% isn't the problem. It's usually 2%, which is considered high fat. But in any case, it's flavored milk. And that was part of what Purdue is bringing back. Flavor means loading it with sugar.
Okay, we're talking to Corby Kummer, our food guy. So Whole Foods is having a little difficulty, I guess, from this new so-called activist investor as well as from a lot of competition. What's
Can I tell
on?
You something? I'm sick of these Whole Foods stories. I shop at Whole Foods, half there, half market. But every day there's a story about the obvious. Whole Foods used to essentially dominate the field. They were it. And now they're competitors. What's the big deal? I don't understand why everybody's has their you-know-whats in a bundle over this. Do you?
Their knickers in a twist.
Exactly. That's what I was... I mean, who cares?
So I read this story in the Times about a new activist investor
yes.
who is the second largest shareholder in all of Whole Foods saying... you aren't managing it well. You're losing a lot of your market share. You should be lowering your prices. We're going to be more activists. But I kept looking for the actual news because there's been so much about Whole Foods losing
exactly.
market share in the past couple of months. And I thought, what's different about this? There's nothing that's different about it. And if you like to shop in Whole Foods, as I do, because it has the best produce around where I live in Jamaica Plain, if I lived in Watertown, I'd go to Russo's, I'd go to other places, but I don't live in Watertown.
That is correct.
So I'll continue to shop
if you
at
lived
Whole
in
Foods.
Ohio, you'd probably shop somewhere else too, wouldn't you? Probably.
Or upper New York State, I'd
exactly.
shop at Wegmans.
That's another
I mean,
good
it just
point.
Depends on who gets the produce and what you can afford. So you go to Market Baskets, what you can afford. There's always going to be competition. I'm not worried about Whole Foods surviving. It's going to survive. I'm fascinated by, I was just talking with a friend about the design of the Ink Block store, which is a huge,
oh, huge.
Very fancy Whole Foods in the fashionable South End.
One of the best
development.
Supermarkets on the planet. Is it not? You don't like it?
Yeah, I do like it, but what I am interested in is the very high profit margin cosmetics right near the cash registers. So it's forced traffic that you have to pass through the highest profit margin goods before you can
like
get
what?
To the cash register. Like face creams.
Oh, okay.
Like nutritional supplements, which
okay.
are also enormously high margin. So it's the design of places, you know, the things that are going to make you healthier but actually have a much higher margin for Whole Foods.
Okay, so we shouldn't worry about Whole Foods is the bottom
line.
Well,
especially since we read this other story that they're doing this thing with chicken. You grow a chicken, you raise a chicken. They're raising
you
chicken
put in a little petri dish
at a slower pace, which apparently, according to them, I have no idea if this is true, ultimately will make them tastier. And they never make the, is it tastier because they live a better life, because they're not like fattened up as quickly as these tired old chickens that could barely stand up at the end of the game? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it is. But Whole Foods is just one of many places that are going to order chickens from from Purdue Farms. Isn't this great?
But it's not the same. It's not the same Purdue.
Yeah, it's a distant relation, but it's not closely related. Okay. As far as, and I had my students at BU and Tufts look into this. It's a distant relation to the secretary and the chicken makers. But what they're doing is saying we're going to start growing a breed that is much slower to mature. It has smaller breasts and bigger thighs, like some of our favorite people. And
that is really totally inappropriate, I should say.
Sorry, but they...
What's your email address so they can email you directly?
They still are our favorite people.
He's laughing at his own joke. I we'll hate have, that, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
They have more fun, these little chickens. They have a nicer life.
They have a nicer life. They drink less water, which means that you're paying for less water in the meat, and they produce less waste. What do we call chicken waste euphemistically on the radio? It's easier to clean up and it's less polluting.
But the price is going to go up to the longer it lives. I'm for this.
Sure.
But obviously the chicken that comes out of that chicken is going to be much more expensive.
Well, there's less feed. So feed is very expensive, and the chickens that are bred to be very fast to raise have very high appetites because their metabolism is very high. These have lower appetites, so it's less food. But yes, the longer anything takes to raise, the longer cheese takes to age. Time is money, so yes, you will pay more, but it will have higher flavor, and yes, they'll lead better lives.
Okay. And also, I mean, a lot of people are getting on board here. They talk about this Bon Appetit management, which supplies all these college kitchens and Aramark,
including MIT.
Yeah.
I can't remember their other clients. They have huge customers. They're owned by Compass Food Group, which is one of the two biggest college food companies.
Exactly, and they've got in here Starbucks, Mexican Chipotle. I can never pronounce that.
I want to hear you pronounce. No, let her pronounce it.
Chipotle.
That's right.
Chipotle.
That's
okay. Subway. I mean, these are not exactly, you know, you can think
high
of Subway
end,
as a high-end restaurant.
No, and what's
so
Stephanie,
this is a trend. And is this a trend because people are concerned about animal welfare?
Partly it's animal welfare. Partly it's flavor. One of the great Whole Foods and Panera Bread, our very own Panera Bread, were the first two big companies to put in orders so that they can say it's antibiotic-free, it has a better life, it's raised under more humane conditions, and it's got better flavor. We don't have to slather it with marinade to have actual old-fashioned chicken flavor. That's a very nice claim. I will be interested in tasting the chickens.
Have you eaten any of these? Have you tasted any of these
No,
slower chickens?
I've had many, many heirloom breed chickens.
Can you taste the difference?
Which are great. Yeah, I can.
A blind test, you could really tell the difference?
Well, you know
yeah,
what?
I've done blind tastings.
And you can tell the difference between a fattened up, artificially whatever chicken and an heirloom chicken.
And when you, and when you roast
them. It's not that amazing. You would
When you roast them, the color of the runoff from the naturally raised versus the naturally raised, it's a totally different color.
Well, I like that you are completely convinced about this.
Marcy, in your signature dish, which of course...
But I was worried about, like a lot of people were worried about antibiotics in their kids' food.
In your signature dish, prune chicken.
Prune chicken.
We know,
that's
right. Do you use the heirloom chicken or do you use the traditional fast fattened chicken?
I go to Whole Foods and use the one that's really expensive because it bothers me to eat food that I think is full of all this horrible stuff.
Good for you.
Yeah.
You ever had her prune chicken, by the way?
It's delicious.
I have not had hers, but I've had chicken Marbella, the famous Silver Palace
that's
recipe,
right.
Which is the prune chicken.
They don't call it prune chicken. They call it
you
chicken Marbella, which sounds
I actually
nicer.
Prefer to call it prune chicken because it says what it is.
Exactly.
It's really good with capers. It's really delicious.
It really is quite good.
So a little scam afoot with organic milk. What's going on here, please?
Oh, the organic milk story. So
yes.
You have to refresh me on that.
This is High Plains Dairy. Apparently, some people went out and did some investigation. The Washington Post reporters did and found that they seemed to be not telling the truth about the cows grazing.
Who's surprised? Do you remember, was it the Seinfeld show about non-fat yogurt and they go out to Queens or wherever they make it and they, of course, find out it's not non-fat yogurt? Who's surprised that organic milk is not organic?
So the problem with organic milk, and this story is only going to get, there's going to have more of this. So we've had food fraud with seafood.
Yes,
we
have right here.
We're going to have more food fraud. I went to a symposium on food fraud just last week, an international symposium. It's spices. Spices. They're full of twigs and bark and dirt. and you buy your own and you grind it, or you get it from Oleana and Sofra and places that import their own spices, but spices are huge food fraud. Why is organic only going to grow? Because one of the reasons that Whole Foods is losing market share is because Costco and Walmart and many other places are getting into the organic produce and organic food business. They see that there's a market for it. They can get higher margins for it and charge higher prices. So it's great. And I think this is terrific because consumers can get more and more organic food. What does it mean? That there's less organic food to go around and it's more expensive, and there's going to be much more food passed off as organic that isn't. And there's a great story on a website called newfoodeconomy.com, which is only on the web, about organic transition, which is now being... There can be a label that says this is being transitioned to organic. It takes 3 years to be certified as organic because you have to wean the land. You have to clean up the land by waiting 3 years of organic crops so that you get rid of all the junk that Marjorie doesn't want in her chicken, for example, and you shouldn't want it in your produce either. It takes 3 years. That's really expensive. So some of the farmers have wanted to say, I want to be able to label it that it's transitional. I'm doing this. I'm going through the motions. And the problem is it won't be as high a markup as organic. And organic producers who have waited, not had the opportunity to have this transitional price, are very angry that they'll be undercut.
They should have a fraud label on them, too, so you can know.
Yeah, that's
mean?
Next.
That's Corby, yeah. It's great to see you, as always.
Okay, Corby Cummer is a contributor to Boston Public Radio, a columnist for The New Republic, senior editor at The Atlantic, and restaurant critic for Boston Magazine.
Jeez.
Corby, thank you very much. I want to remind people that Tom Rush, the legendary Tom Rush, is going to be singing for us right here in the Boston Public Library later today.
Yes.
Fred Wiseman is going to be here, the documentary filmmaker as well. But coming up right after the news is Emily Rooney, the Commissioner of Common Sense,
too.
And her world-renowned list of proclamations and preoccupations. I'm going to talk a little bit about Fenway Park as well. Emily Rooney next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Library, live from the Boston Public Radio, live at the library. That's it.
At noon on today's BPR from the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, it's Emily Rooney on racism at Fenway, the spate of hit and runs in Massachusetts, and of course, her famous list of fixations and culminations.
Then two legends in a row, first singer-songwriter Tom Rush, and we are so excited. He's going to serenade us live right here at the Boston Public Library. Then legendary filmmaker Fred Wiseman, creator of Tinicut Follies, the 67 one-span documentary on the horrors at Bridgewater's Prison for the Criminally Insane. Wiseman has a new retrospective at the MFA. Then Boston Globe columnist Shirley Leung will tell us whether Ivanka Trump, whose new book, Women Who Work, just hit the stores, is the new feminist icon, God help us. And for our Friday news quiz, the folks from Peerless, this fantastic new play about high school kids' nefarious schemes to get into college. All that on Boston Public Radio. Mr. Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, and we are broadcasting live because it's Friday.
It is Friday.
We're also here on Tuesdays.
That is correct.
It's not Tuesday today. It's
no,
Friday
it's not
today.
Tuesday, no.
We're here at the Boston Public Library in the Back Bay, corner of Boylston Street and Exeter Street. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. And here with us with her famous list of what some might call fixations and fulminations is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press. Hello there, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hello there,
great
Emily.
To see you.
Well, I know you want to talk a little bit about all the goings-on at Fenway Park, the Baltimore Oriole player that was called the N-word from the stands, had peanuts thrown at him, and this incident with this man, white guy, and his biracial son at the park. So tell us what your take is.
Well, first of all, I have no doubt it happened. If these individuals say it happened, then it happened. The thing that concerns me a little bit, and Kevin Cullen touched upon it in his, I thought, terrific column this morning, was how there haven't been witnesses coming forward. And I don't know whether the Red Sox are trying to discover the details behind this or the news media is trying to do it, but somebody should get to the details behind the first incident, because the second incident has been quite well vetted, I think.
Well, the second incident was person to person, so there's no reason to think there even are witnesses.
Oh,
right?
No, but there were. there
but,
were.
But that's yeah. a person-to-person
but,
statement.
But then that's one person's word against the other, because actually they ended up believing the guy who said that that this guy had said something derogatory about
the... Rich, which the guy denied. That's
yeah, he
correct.
Denied. But it was one person, but yeah. at least, you know, they had an individual. I mean, the individual who threw the peanuts has not been named. Why not? I mean, if this guy got thrown out of the park, that's a matter of record.
Well,
he gets thrown out of the park.
So what's the implication here that Adam Jones, the Oriole player, made this up?
No, I don't think there's any implication. I'm certainly not saying that. It's just that it deserves an investigation into who heard it, who said it, because if it was the guy throwing the peanuts, then let's find out if it was the guy throwing the peanuts. If it was somebody else, who was it? And was that guy ejected also? It's like, it's not done yet. The story is still hanging there.
Well, wait a second. When you say there are no implications, maybe there are no implications in you saying it. There are tons of implications on some parts of sports radio,
on Kurt Schilling,
Breitbart,
no, I know that.
Who are saying it's all lies, it's all BS, because there have not been witnesses who've come forward, because people have not been identified.
But how can they
then
say that with any
obviously Adam
kind of
Jones is... They
how
say
can
it.
They say that?
I'm not defending their position. Yeah. I'm just saying they are saying that Adam Jones
why would
is
he
lying.
Make that up?
I'm with you. I don't think most people say that it's something they want to go through by announcing it and then have to answer questions about it.
Right.
I'm with you on this thing. I'm just saying there's a significant chunk of the sports media who, either to be provocateurs or because they really believe it, are saying this is total BS.
Well, it's all the more reason why it's probably incumbent on the news media, not even necessarily the sports departments, because that's not necessarily their milieu, is to figure out what exactly happened. My guess is somebody will, but it's even like there's all these things that are hanging. You know, yesterday they came out with that report about Aaron Hernandez and his final hours in prison, but they failed to say who the three notes were written to. Why?
Well, it was redacted. The
why?
I don't know why. I guess the argument was the document that was released yesterday not just about the cause of death and related things, and I guess you could make the case, at least in that setting. I'm not defending them. I'm totally with you.
And also, it's one thing to print the contents of the notes. That's fine. That can be personal. But to who the notes were written to? I mean, it is a matter of public interest.
You know, the thing I hadn't thought much about before until you said it, I hadn't read Kevin's column yet this morning, is it is interesting. The Red Sox, in my estimation, deserve praise for immediately putting out a statement condemning this thing.
Yeah.
Kennedy, Sam Kennedy, the president,
met with
Adam Jones.
And then Henry met with the players.
But the fact that they haven't identified people I hadn't thought about is quite interesting. The other thing I wanted to run by you, we discussed this with Brian McGorry yesterday, editor of the Globe, who obviously works for the same guy owns the Red Sox. I didn't even know about this till I read a piece in the Washington Post yesterday morning. There is a habit, and I think it's fair to call it a habit because it's been done regularly. When there are racist taunts in soccer stadiums in particular, in parts of Europe, Western and Eastern Europe, you know what the reaction often is? To shut down the stadium for at least one or two future games, if not indefinitely.
Really?
They call them closed door events.
So they'll play the game, but they won't let
with
the public
no
in?
Fans.
I love that.
So that they're making this incredibly powerful statement.
Yeah, that's good.
I have to say, I've never heard of it
until
yesterday, but it's
well,
not just
make
one place.
You take the people, you take that's everybody's money, but you won't let them in.
But you don't make the money is the bottom line. And, you know, I'll tell you, talk about a statement, a powerful statement that would be remembered for a long time. I don't know what the impact would be, but to my knowledge, it's never been done here. Yeah. But people should read the Washington Post story. It's pretty impressive.
So, Emily, you brought up, there have been some recent tragedies with hit-and-run accidents, a bicyclist, a four-year-old child a few weeks ago. You raised a great question this morning. What's up with these
people? You know, I became obsessed with hit-and-runs about 3 or 4 years ago because it seemed to me that there was just an unbelievable spate of them in and around the city and other areas. I mean, I actually did research, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them in the greater Boston area.
I should mention the man who was just killed. He was 29 years old,
Richard Archer
of South Boston, killed by a hit-and-run driver.
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm most curious about, and by the way, the one that they just picked up yesterday, that little boy ran into the street. I mean, he's 4 years old. He ran into the street. Why would somebody not stop? Is it because they're drunk? Is it because they're afraid? Same with the...
And then the woman made up a story.
And she
said
she was...
She must, the damage was something. On her car was from a tree branch.
She must have had, you know, something substance in her blood. There's got to be a reason that you can rationally think to yourself, I'm not going to stop.
Well, you know, we actually... And because you wanted to talk about it, Marjorie and I read a little bit about this morning. there are a lot. One thing is quite clear, which surprises me, is that every article we read said how little research there's been done.
Yeah, I know.
The only point they make, which is pathetically obvious, but I hadn't thought about it, as much as we condemn, as we should, these people, the act is not premeditated. So it's different from other kinds of horrible things. It happens. And then they say in some of the analyses that have been done, and there aren't many, say it's a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
Immediately they start to say it's not my fault. Yeah. It's the fault of the person who ran in front of my car. In the other cases, it's more obvious. They're drunk. Yep. They're scared out of their minds, whatever it is. But there's been no – the point is, in light of the fact that there's been almost no analysis – then there's no ability as a public health kind of thing to figure out how you try to stop.
It's a fascinating thing because
the running part of it when it happens.
Have you ever put yourself in that position? Like, you know, it's the middle of the night, and what was that Bonfire of the Vanities? Wasn't that kind of kind of thing?
My favorite book of all time,
where they killed a woman on an off-ramp or an on-ramp.
Was it a woman
or was it a man?
And took off.
South Bronx, right.
And it's like, what
he was a master of the universe, and then you're forever after tortured by the thinking you're going to get found out, which you eventually do.
Yeah, you eventually do get found out.
This guy, they found the car of the other guy in the
Now, what is he thinking? He puts the car in the Boston Common Garage.
Yeah.
We don't know if it's a man or a woman, by the way. They haven't found this person.
It was a New York plate.
Seems like it would be fairly easy to apprehend that individual.
You're right, because I always assume it's a man, but it was a woman in the case of the 4-year-old.
Right. You know, I've told you this, which of course you've totally forgotten, but I haven't told you this. When I had my store on the Cape, we call it a store, not
Jim
a head
was
shop.
A leather merchant.
I was in Providence.
Dope paraphernalia.
Well, it was, but it was perfectly legal. There's nothing wrong with that, my friend. Thank you.
I think
and
I
we
was
did
there
quite well. I bet you were. Actually, you were a regular customer. Now I know where I met you.
Bongs and Providence.
Oh, wait a second. There's a serious part to this. You have obviously totally forgotten.
I've forgotten.
We're driving back from Boston after we loaded up our car with a lot of stuff, including that paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. We're driving down Route 6, right where it turns. You know where all the dunes are on the right-hand side? You finally enter Provincetown, and it curves way. A woman, it turns out, who had just arrived visiting her children from Germany the day before, walks across Route 6. I'm not driving. The guy who works for me is driving. We hit this woman head-on, and to this day, and it was decades ago, I can still see her body tumbling through the air before. No, she broke a hip. Luckily, she broke it. And we did stop. I'm not saying that to congratulate ourselves at all. I'm just saying it is as terrifying as anything you can possibly imagine.
Well, even hitting
somebody's It's not justifying ever leaving the scene. But it is. I don't think anything has freaked me out as much as that moment.
I hit a raccoon once.
Yeah.
Did you run off or did you stop?
Well, my three little children in the back of my car, it was like at midnight.
But if it's somebody's domestic...
What are you going to do? Take it to the emergency room?
Exactly.
What are you supposed to do?
I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do? Am I going to get out and try to rescue the raccoon with my three kids in the back?
The thing you don't want to hit is a deer. Then you're lucky to be alive.
Terrible about it, though. Yeah. Yeah. I hope it was quick.
One last thing about it. I'm going to state the obvious, and you don't have to say it's obvious because I know it is. Is in many of these situations, like when little kid ran out, if you do stop, I know people don't think this clearly in a moment of panic.
You're not in that much trouble.
You're not in exactly.
Unless you're drunk.
That is correct. And by the way, I forgot. I don't know if I put that on the list. In many of these cases, people are drunk, which is an explanation.
But this was Easter Sunday at 4 in the afternoon. I know.
In any case.
Bad decision.
So the Kentucky Derby is tomorrow. Yes. You apparently are worked into a frenzy over some story about thoroughbreds today.
No, I actually really like the Kentucky Derby. I get kind of weepy. I see the majesty of those horses and everything. But when I think about horse racing, I get really upset. So racing in general, it's a brutal sport and it's cruel.
Yeah.
It's cruel. I mean, you know, these animals, they're so fragile. You know, they got 2,000 pounds on the 4,000, whatever it is, on those spindly little legs. And most of the horses are just instantly put down. So there's this, you know, like 5,000-word article in the New York Times today about this horse named Majesty.
Mastery,
who they try to save. It broke its leg, broke its ankle. But, I mean, you know, the only reason they're saving this horse is because it's going to be valuable in stud. But, you know, the truth is that thousands of these animals are put down every year. You know,
thousands of thoroughbreds. Yes, you don't think it's thoroughbreds.
I know.
It is pretty.
I mean, it's when you really think about it, it's, you know, all these people out there with their, you know, big hats on and
you know,
everything.
While we're trying to psychoanalyze people who do hit and run, have you ever been psychoanalyzed vis-a-vis? You're the big, one of the most, the best animal people ever, which doesn't fit your M.O. I hope you don't take that in the wrong way.
Yeah.
But it really doesn't fit who you are, do you know? So what do you think that's about? Was this something when you were a kid? Did you have pets when you were a kid growing up?
I don't know. I've just always been kind of in touch with, you know, nature, animals, domestic and wild animals. I don't know.
It's all those birds she sees outside.
I'm a big bird person.
Big bird person. Very concerned about the birds.
I like birds of prey.
You know.
I bet you do. What a shock that is.
I just take this opportunity to point out for people who haven't seen it. One of my favorite movies of all time, Secretariat.
Yeah, I know.
I always
love
to watch that.
Okay.
If you don't want to watch
and
the entire movie, Seabiscuit is great, too. Yeah. If you don't want to watch the entire movie, you can just Google Secretariat.
We have a surprise for you. Because I knew if we talked about horse racing, you'd bring it up. Here is the stretch run of Secretariat.
Oh, at the Belmont.
In the Belmont.
This is the real deal. Yeah. 1973.
Listen up.
The Secretariat is all alone. He's out there almost a 16th of a mile away from the rest of the horses. Secretariat is in a position that seems impossible to catch. He's into the stretch. Secretariat leads his field by 18 lengths. Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front.
How pathetic that this is her favorite movie. That was the real
deal.
That was the real goal.
I always cry at the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, I
wait a second. You've been to the Kentucky Derby?
No,
watching on TV.
No, I'm with you. I was because the horses are so beautiful.
I know.
But we should point out the Secretariat, who did go on to a long life, is a stud, and he died. He died fairly early for a horse.
I think he was like 30 or something.
Well, in any case, they did do an autopsy of Secretariat and discovered that he had an enormous heart.
That's right.
And that's what enabled him to have the endurance to
run so far. All of those races.
If people haven't seen it, you can Google it. You can just watch this horse going faster and faster.
25
lengths.
How many times have you seen the movie, Margaret?
Oh, my God. At least 7 times.
Really,
and, you know, it's not just about horses. It's about this woman who went to Smith College, true story, and was ridiculed because she was a woman in the horse business. Yeah. And she picked the right horse. Yeah. I mean, she studied the breeding and all this kind of stuff. And it's also about the 60s and about her
women and
women. And it's a great, it's not a great movie, actually, but it's
well, that scene is great.
By the way, you were right, and Emily and I are wrong. The Secretariat only lived till 19. I thought Secretariat was 30 or something.
Yeah, I knew that he had some disease. I forget what happened to him, but he died. Anyway, we have to move on.
By the way, we're going to play that sound by 3 or 4 more times before 2 o'clock, so please don't.
Do they have the line where he said he's moving like a fantastic machine?
No, we don't.
Oh, my God.
Cut that line, Jim. Cut that line to upset you.
Yeah, he did.
Okay. Now that we've gotten through that, why Emily is here, as you know, is the same reason every week, and it is this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
She doesn't, but she does today. So what is it, thematic
it
or is it participatory?
Excuse me. We should point out, because we don't give Emily enough credit for her list. There's a lot of work putting these lists together. We discussed that this morning. It's a lot of work, and we appreciate it.
And by the way, did you get feedback on your prison reform list from last week?
I heard from some prisoners.
Did you actually, the list on the show?
And I heard from a guy on Twitter. Did you see that guy?
No.
He said, for the first time in 20 years, I agree with something Emily Rooney said.
Is that really true? Oh, that's pretty
good.
Yeah,
it was prison reform.
I love that.
So I was like...
Okay, so what's the list this
week,
please?
All right, so you know how I'm never embarrassed to kind of admit what I don't know?
Right.
That's correct.
Me too.
So this is things that I have to look up every year, even though I look them up every year.
Oh, that's an excellent list.
You know?
Excellent.
So, like, today is what?
May 5th.
Cinco de Mayo.
Do you know what the heck it is?
No.
Yeah, I know.
No,
what is it?
It's okay, tell us.
I know. Cinco de Mayo. It's the Mexican Army's victory over the French forces at the Battle of Puebla.
Of course.
Not to be confused with Mexican Independence Day, which is a lot of people apparently think it's Mexican.
Yeah, I thought it was Mexican Independence Day.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Now, before you leave that topic, here's a quiz for you, if I may.
Uh-oh.
What person who you know relatively well on May 1st turns to me and says, oh, my God, it's Cinco de Mayo.
What?
Exactly.
Would be,
who would have been? Oh, it was
that
you. That's exactly right.
Yes.
Okay.
I kind of botched
all right, Jim,
that one.
This is one.
Go ahead.
You know, and I don't want to stereotype or anything,
that's fine,
but I have to look this up every year.
What
I'm not even
it?
Sure I'm going to say it right. Sukkot or Sukkoth?
Sukkoth. But some people, Sukkoth is how I pronounce it when I was a little Jewish boy growing up.
I can never remember what it is. Seven days festival of the Feast of the Booths.
Okay.
And it represents the years Jewish people spent in the desert.
Okay, fine.
Is Did you know that?
I really don't know.
That's when people build the huts.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Good, the Catholic knew the answer to that question.
Well, because everybody in Brookline has a little hut.
That's a very good point. Go ahead.
I mean, honestly, this is embarrassing.
What is it?
I can never remember what the heck St. Patrick's Day is about.
It's just about commemorating the guy that came over and that came over and brought Catholicism to Ireland. I don't know why.
That's exactly right.
I don't know why it's March 17th.
Christianity to the Emerald.
He was British, wasn't he?
Honor the patron saint of Ireland,
yeah,
who brought Christianity
right.
to the...
It's fine.
Do you not care?
I don't care that much. No, I actually
don't. But, I mean, we celebrate these things. Like,
we
know what they mean.
We do.
Well, it's a big Irish holiday is basically what it is. And, of course, in Massachusetts, is one of our staff people just reminded us, it's Evacuation Day.
Exactly, which
so
is a state holiday.
County, everybody has a
Wait,
day
is it
off.
A holiday? Is it Suffolk County holiday? County. That's right. Do you remember the great line, by the way? What was the name of the state senator who actually liked Jack somebody or other?
Jack Hart.
Jack Hart, who stood up when were about to eliminate Evacuation Day as a Suffolk County holiday.
Yeah.
He says, what's next? Thanksgiving? Christmas? Where do we stop?
I know.
In any case.
Okay, Jim, in your community of Cambridge,
yes,
they celebrate a holiday called Eid.
Yes, we do.
E-I-D.
I do.
What is that?
It's a Muslim holiday.
But what is it?
I have no idea. I don't. But I know it is a day off from school.
It's a day off from school.
Yeah.
Second of two Muslim holidays celebrated worldwide each year honors the willingness of Abraham to sacrifice his son to God. We are celebrating somebody who sacrificed their child.
That's one of the most gruesome passages in the entire Bible.
I totally agree.
That's
horrible.
I mean, what do you say after that? You tie your kid up.
It's like the story of Ruth. Oh, I was traumatized by that movie. Remember the story of Ruth, that little girl, and they drive the stake through her heart?
Exactly.
Like, oh, my God.
I would say you'd have some trust issues with Dad after that.
You might. I had some trust issues with Dad apart from that. So what's next, please?
And is this embarrassing? Or
it's a little
father
embarrassing.
Father went to jail.
Bastille Day.
Excuse me. My father did not go to jail.
That's
he was disbarred. He did not go to jail.
That's his story.
He was disbarred.
He's sticking to
Bastille Day.
Bastille Day.
Of course. That's when they erected the Bastille.
Beheading everybody.
Who cares? What is it?
No,
what
come
is
on. It? It's again, you know, this that they shut down half the Back Bay
to celebrate
Bastille Day.
And what is it again?
Celebrated on July 14th, commemorates the storming of the Bastille.
Sure it does.
On July 14th, 1789, it was a turning point in the French Revolution.
That's why they call it Bastille Day, by the way. Thank you.
So are there more beheadings or fewer beheadings after Bastille
I don't know anything
Day.
About the beheadings.
The guillotine.
Guillotine.
Mount Lafarge.
You're right, Jim, you're going to get this one, but
okay,
I can never remember it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Ides of March?
That's when Brutus killed Julius Caesar.
I didn't know that.
Excellent.
Either. Is that what it is?
Yes.
You really, it's like a quiz kind of thing. You're doing great, Marjorie. It's really good. Go ahead. Next.
All right, this is embarrassing.
Embarrassing.
Like I said, I'm not afraid to admit it. Flag Day.
I have no idea.
It's the day after my birthday.
Is that true? It's June 13th?
It's June 14th.
June 14th.
Your birthday is the 13th.
That's right. That's don't know what it's about. I should wave your flag on Flag Day. Is that what you're supposed to do?
Commemorates the adoption of the flag of the United States. What's happened on June 14th, 1777, so a year after.
Okay. Are you upset that you don't know these things, or you're just observing?
I think I should know, and I'm feeling like an idiot.
Well, I don't know any of them.
I can't remember.
What's the next one?
All right. This is another Muslim one, but it's Ramadan,
which
is coming up, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, at the end of the
month. Go ahead, Marjorie. Take it away.
Yeah.
All I know is you can only eat one meal a day. And after
sundown.
So you're like, it's really hard if you're a Muslim kid playing sports. Mm. I used to hear that a lot when my kids were at Brooklyn High School.
It's the renewing of family ties.
Yeah.
Of course.
So why can't you eat?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Go ahead, next. That's it?
That's it.
So wait a second. What were those things you don't understand?
Things I have to look up every year.
Oh, because I thought it was things you don't understand, and you were going to add
the new
Republican health care bill. I thought you could put on that list.
I heard you guys talking about that. I don't know. I'm beside myself. I wouldn't want to take a quiz on that.
Actually, we could do fairly. We are both obsessed. We might do at least like a B- on that. So, Emily Rooney, beat the press tonight at 7 o'clock.
Actually,
what are you doing?
I've got this thing. I heard you guys talking about Stephen Colbert, but I'm doing this thing about who took off on Trump the other night.
Yeah.
About.
Do you think he went over the line?
I thought it was okay. He's a comedian. But
I thought he went way over the line.
The things that people are daring to say, and I'm talking about regular reporters and columnists, and the things that people are saying, it's the language used to describe them. It's actually fairly shocking.
You're talking about Donald Trump?
I mean, there's just absolutely no pretense of respect. None. It's
gone.
Well,
can I tell you, the debate I had with, I know Marjorie and maybe you, and maybe with Brian McGorry, was when the word lie was used for the first time during the campaign. And I know this whole debate happened with the Wall Street Journal and I think the New York Times. Obviously, lie, the word means there was an intent. I think that
but
was the point after. No,
that.
I know it's gone way, but I think that was the point.
The health care bill is a great example, though. He's up there saying it's got a fantastic plan. It's going to be great. Everybody's going to see it.
And the way he talks. And that's what George Will's point is.
But that's not true. He's lying.
No, but he doesn't know. And George Will is making the point. He's a conservative columnist. He's saying he doesn't have a sequential thought process. Therefore, he can't really explain anything. He can't do it. It's going to be fantastic, and it's a wonderful thing, and the people are really going to like it.
So what
excuse
he
me, you don't think
anything.
He's lying. You've said repeatedly you think he doesn't understand what's
doesn't
in the bill.
He doesn't understand it.
Well, I think if you watch cable television like he supposedly does nonstop, and you hear everybody saying over and over again that it's not going to do what he says it's going to do.
He doesn't know.
Excuse me, Fox News doesn't say it's not going to do what he's...
Well, he apparently watches CNN quite a bit, too, where they are saying it. So if he didn't know it beforehand, I would think he would know it after
this. He doesn't know. Did you see that interview with John Dickerson?
That was one of the most unbelievable
things. And I'm going to use a clip of that, too. Anyway,
did you know The New Yorker has a piece about his...
I read it.
What did you think?
Oh,
mental health.
Yeah.
They're saying that he has mental health problems.
Yeah.
Okay, what else are you doing?
All right, we're doing that. We're doing this whole dust up with the – I think it's a good issue. So a reporter of the Herald was suspended for a few days for tweeting out something about the Aaron Hernandez
Villani.
Case.
I don't know his first name.
Villani,
but his name is Villani,
And, you know, the managers over there said, hey, it's policy. You know, you have to run anything breaking news before you tweet. And you know what? There's a liability issue. I mean, anyway, it's a good discussion because a lot of people in the union and – a lot of reporters think it was a total overreaction. I'm not so sure I'm convinced. I thought maybe it was decent policy. Anyway, we got that and a couple other things.
Great. We'll
all
be
right.
watching. Nice to see Emily.
Okay. She is Emily Rooney. She joins us every Friday. Of course, you can keep up with her right here on WGBH. Two Friday nights, Beat the Press, 7 o'clock. Must watch listening for certainly press geeks like myself. Thank you very much, Emily.
Great to
coming
see you,
up, the man that Jim Browdy rhapsodizes about 24/7.
I'm fond of his
singer,
work.
Songwriter, the great talent, Tom Rush. He's going to play for us right here live at the Boston Public Library. We're also going to get his take on how the music industry has changed since he became part of it and what his connection is to the Chinese crested dog. Tom Rush next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us for some live music and to talk about how the music industry has changed is a man who had a role in changing the music industry. Can we have a round of applause for the great singer-songwriter, Tom Rush? Great to see you, Tom. Thanks for coming down.
Thanks so much for having me. I love this,
setup
you've got.
Is it unbelievable? What a venue.
Is it great?
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
And the coffee's probably better, too.
The coffee's
News
delicious.
Newsfeed Cafe. It's excellent. Come on down.
So before we begin, I just have to say, as I said before, I mean, this is like a total bromance. You have just seduced this man. He talks about you all the time. Now, when I was in college, my roommate and I had the picture of you. I don't know what album it was, but you got the purple shirt on, you got the big mustache, you got all the hair, all the curls. Which album is that, please?
I think it's just called Tom Rush.
Okay, whatever it was called.
Hell of a title,
we had
I
that.
Should say.
Right. Really
I thought that up. I thought that up myself.
We had it on the wall. We were total groupies, you know, like, oh, Tom Rush saw you perform.
So what are you
else.
Criticizing me for?
But, I mean, really, he's almost turned me against you. All he does is talk about you, so I don't understand
I was
what's going
say,
on here.
I'm very glad you're back from vacation because you have a calming effect on him.
He
tends to run amok when you're not here.
I'm going to tell my story is exactly like yours, and then I'll shut up.
Okay.
When I was in college, I used to go see you. You know the story. I used to go see you in and around Greater Philadelphia. I was a huge fan. I actually, I've said this, is a little embarrassing. I wanted to be Tom Rush. And then a couple of decades
later, you walked
into our studio, and I met you, and I was thrilled. And now I go see you play all the time, and
Sally
I love
and I
you.
Wanted to marry Tom Rush. It didn't quite work out
deal.
For us, but you know, we tried.
And you dodged the bullet, too.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the difference in the music industry. Like, you used to have to go to the record labels, I guess, when you began and try to... tell us what it was like when you first started and what it's like now.
It's really gone through a huge sea change. When I started out, if you didn't have a record deal, you didn't exist. Because the record company was the one who got you on the radio, they got you in the record stores, they promoted your tours. And without that, you were invisible. Nobody knew you were there. And I was lucky that I came along when I did, when the bar wasn't quite so high. And then it got to the point where you had to look good in spandex and have dance steps and all that.
That is true, actually.
But tell what you're doing decades later. Your next album is a function of what process?
Hold on. Before we get to decades later, though, was it the deal where you had to put together a whole bunch of songs and then you had to, you know, send them to some record company? I mean, how'd you do it? What are you looking for, Tom?
I was looking for my other guitar over there.
Okay.
Oh, I'll go get it. I can do that.
But so how did that work?
Well, basically, I was lucky, I guess. Nobody was telling me what songs to do.
Okay.
Up until my last album with Columbia. Then they did get a little pushy. We want you to do this one, that one.
Oh.
But up until then, I could call the shots. I could do what I wanted and pick the producer and the musicians. And so it was all very very liberal, and I guess I was lucky in that regard, because other artists were very much managed and told what to do and what to wear, even.
And in 2017, it's a totally different kettle of fish.
So totally.
You're doing a crowd funding kind of thing, right?
Crowdsourcing thing, yeah. The industry contracts were very, very harsh, and they wanted a piece of everything forever. And now with the internet, you can go straight to the audience. And I'm doing, for this next album, which I'm about to, I'm going to Nashville next week to start recording, which I'm very excited about. But you can go straight to the audience and raise the money to make an album. And it's...
Are you doing that now? Is this on Pledge Music or whatever the hell it's called?
It's on Pledge Music. There's actually a link. If you go to tomrush.com, there's a link to it.
And how's that going? Whoa. How's that going?
Well, it's going great. I mean, they... Pledge wants you to raise 25% of your goal within the first week. We raised it within the first hour.
Oh my gosh. That's great. So
now we've reached the original goal, which was to fund the recording session. Now we're shooting for the artwork and the
But you're a well-known established guy. Is that good for somebody that's trying to break in?
It would be harder. It would be a lot harder for somebody just trying to break in. But the internet is a terrifying thing, but it enables all kinds of great music and all kinds of terrible music. But anybody with a laptop can make an album, record something,
that's true.
Put it out there, see if it gets traction.
So do you think overall for musicians now that it's better this way to be able to go direct to the audience and get around the record industry or not?
You have to define musicians.
Okay.
What does that mean?
The songwriters aren't doing as well, because it's very hard to get paid for your songwriting these days, because so much is free on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard for the record companies, the big ones or the little ones, to make money selling CDs, because everything's free on the internet.
Yeah.
So where I've always made my living is on stage, and that's, that has gotten better for the people who can get on stage and do a show.
Well, you're on a stage today, my friend. What are you going to play for us?
Well... I was going to play you... Actually, this is a brand new one, and I was going to do it first in case it sucks.
Okay, that's right. It's a very healthy attitude, by the way. Thank you.
Hey, little mama, come see by me. See how your daddy done done. Hey, little mama, come see by me. Round about the setting sun. I might be good, I might be bad. I might be happy, but I might be sad. Hey, little mama, come see by me. Coming down the road, take me by the hand. Hey, little mama coming down the road, take me to the promised land. I might be up, I might be down, I might be lost, but I might be found. Hey, little mama, come see by me. Mama, you're the one I love. You know that to be true. Hey, little mama, you're the one I love. I hate to see you blue. I might be rich, I might be poor, I might be home. Hey, little mama, come see by me. It's a new song. Hey. See by me, see how your daddy done. Hey, little mama, come see by me, round about the setting sun. I might be good, might be bad, might be happy, but I might be sad. Hey, little mama, come see by me.
Tom Rush.
We think that's a good one. We like that one. Yeah.
You ever played in the library before?
Keep that one.
No.
This is it, huh?
This is it. This is my first visit.
How many things do you do a year now? I see you often at the Natick Center for the Arts, which is a fabulous location. How many things do you do a year?
I do TCAN, the Natick Center.
I know.
About once a year. I probably do 50, 60 shows.
Why?
Why?
You're not a kid anymore. You know that. Yeah? Why do you do that? Why do you do that? I mean, I love that you do it, but why do you do it?
I think you make some money doing it. That's one reason.
He's saying, where's Jack Kevorkian when we really need him?
No. It's not exactly what I was saying, but why do you do it?
I love playing. I love playing for the folks. It's really a high for me to get on stage and share you know, songs that I am excited about.
Yeah. What's the name of the great young guy who plays with you who is spectacular?
Matt Nakoa.
Matt Nakoa is otherworldly. He is really terrific.
There's good, there's very good, and then there's Matt.
No, he is fabulous.
So what do you do about your voice? Do you worry about keeping your voice, keeping your range? Because you've got a great voice. Still.
Well, thank you.
Well, no, because a lot of people lose their voice.
Well, the lower notes are getting better and better. Yeah. The higher notes I tend to avoid when possible.
Yeah. But do you think that's because, I mean, you hear about all these people like, what's her name, that begins with an A.
That's a good start.
No,
Adele.
Adele that got that had that throat thing going on. You read
In
about
Boston,
that.
She had surgery right
yes.
here.
Yes. And you read about other really great singers that have had that problem. But is it because you're doing a different kind of music?
I honestly don't know. I think it's got to be genetics.
Yeah, maybe.
Partly because I can't claim clean living. I can't claim any of the...
Did you used to smoke?
I did up until I was 30.
And then you stopped?
I stopped on my 30th birthday.
Oh, okay. So when did you start? When you were like 12?
Well, no, it was probably 16, but it was back, you know, when you had, if you didn't smoke,
everybody
you
had to smoke.
You weren't a man.
Absolutely.
Hey, Tom Rush, would you mind? You've told this question, this story on our show before, but the only reason I'm asking you to do it again is because we discussed her the other day. Richard Ortner, who's the retiring head of the Boston Conservatory, was here.
I heard
that.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that he had seen Joni Mitchell 3 times at Carnegie Hall. He was an usher. I mentioned I had seen her at Radio City. You told us the story first time you were on with us about your first encounter with a woman who I would argue is the greatest songwriter of her generation, actually.
I wouldn't argue that. I wouldn't argue
Tell
with
us
that.
About your first encounter. I think it was your first. It was in Detroit or something?
Yeah, it was in Detroit,
Tell
Michigan.
Us about that.
I was playing a little club called The Chessmate, which I played every year. And one year, Joni came in one night, and she knew the owner, and she asked him if she could do a guest set so I could hear some of her songs. What I didn't know was that she had just started writing songs. She was in a duo with her then husband, Chuck Mitchell. And they were doing, I gather, the regular folk stuff, Michael Row the Boat Ashore mm-hmm. and stuff like that. She had just started writing songs. And she came in and did four tunes at the Chessmate and just bowled me over. And she came off stage. I asked her if she had any more songs because I was way overdue for delivering an album to Elektra, like 2 years overdue.
2 years overdue.
Back then it seemed like a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
Now it's nothing, but back then it seemed like a long
time. Yeah, but they thought it was a long time, too.
Yeah, well, they did. They were getting antsy. And she basically said, no, I don't have any more new songs, but give me a minute. And a couple of weeks later sent me a tape with six songs. Just before the last song on the tape, she apologized for it. She said, I just finished writing this. It's not much good. I'm so embarrassed. Here it is. And it was The Circle Game. I named the album after
it. Oh, my God. Oh, you do a great cover.
So wait a second. She just went home, and in that intervening 2 weeks or whatever it was?
It might have been more than 2 weeks, but it was a month at most.
Had you heard of her before she came up
never,
to you at this
never.
Thing? Did you know the second you heard her, that first set of four songs?
Oh, I was on the floor, yeah. She was just, oh, my God.
You know, but speaking of smoking, she's smoked a lot because her voice dramatically changed to her last album, where you could tell this is someone that's been smoking for all those years. I don't think is it correct to call it a cover? It's not a cover when she hadn't like made it for, or is it? Did you say cover of The Circle Game?
My recording.
His was a cover.
Yeah, is that
mine would be a cover whether she'd recorded it or
not. Okay, all right. I wasn't sure if that was the correct terminology.
I think so. I'm not the authority.
Well, I don't know either.
Okay, so you play something else for us. Would you mind doing that?
I've got this guitar. I know this is radio.
It is radio.
Maybe if I hold it up to the microphone, people can see it.
Oh, we can see it now, yes.
It's got a naked lady with a snake wrapped around her, inlaid on the neck.
Yes. I love that.
It's a biblical theme. So I wrote a love song for my guitar.
Oh.
This is a little... I don't know if it's weird or not. But
we'll find out.
She's very attractive. I can see her from
Thank
here.
Thank you very much. And round. She's got a snake tattooed on her good right arm. And sometimes in the night, we'll go dancing. Now, I don't dance, but she don't mind. She keeps the time, and when I drink that wine, she'll keep the time from overflowing. She can cry like the rain in the pines at night, ring like a hammer on a 5-pound spike. She sighs like silk on skin. It's my arms like coming home. And when I'm lost and all alone, she hold me close and whisper about where we've been. My best girl. Whoa, sweet baby mine. Not as young as she once was. She's got the scars from the miles we've shared. But when it rains, she's my silver lining. And everything's wrong and nothing's right. It's darker than the darkest night. My best girl, oh, she comes shining. She can cry like the rain in the pines at night. Ring like a hammer on a 5-pound spike. She sighs like silk on the skin. She fits my arms like coming home. And when I'm lost and all alone, she hold me close and whisper about where we've been. My best girl. Oh, sweet baby mine. Snake tattooed on a good right arm. And sometimes in the night, we'll go dancing. My best girl.
Tom Rush.
Hey, we love songs about girls who are peeking around as not as young as they used to be. I love that.
We're talking to Tom Rush. Who do you listen to these days, Tom Rush?
My daughter's into all kinds of different stuff.
Your daughter, who is
Sienna.
Our intern, whom we
love. Yeah,
loves.
She's great.
Sienna sends her love to you.
We love her. We love her.
Two summers with you guys, and she loved every minute of it.
Every minute of it, she was great. We loved her, too. But what does she listen to that you listen to?
I tend to tune out the rap. I know it's important. I know it's a lot of people love it, and it's my failing that I don't get it. But yeah. I don't get it, so I don't listen to it.
But is there any contemporary person or set of contemporary people
or someone that
loving?
Does similar kind of stuff to what you do? Anybody that you see?
Well, actually, we were talking about Matt Nicola.
Oh yeah,
he's a monster, and he's got a friend who also accompanies me on occasion named Seth Gleer.
So unbelievable.
And the two of them are just monsters, and. I recommend anybody out there to check out Matt Nicola and Seth Gleer.
How do you spell Nicola?
N-A-K-O-A.
Thank you.
And Gleer is G-L-I-E-R.
What kind of stuff's going to be in the new album? Do you call it an album or a CD?
I call it an album.
So
still.
Do I.
It's a collection of songs.
What are you recording in Nashville?
I'm recording those two songs, and it's mainly songs I've written myself, which has never happened before. I think it'll be an entirely self-penned album, except for two traditional songs. And I'm really looking forward to hanging out with these guys in Nashville. They are so good.
Have you recorded in Nashville before?
Once before. My previous studio album was done down there, and I'm kicking myself for having waited so long to do that.
And what is everybody says the most talented musicians, the greatest environment. What can you explain to mere mortals what Nashville has that other
I don't know if it's the water or the air or just, I think it's the community, actually. It's the musical community. They just get better and better feeding off of each other.
Mm. You're getting a lot of kudos over the email. That's very nice.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, once again, TomRush.com has a link to the Pledge Music thing, which the way it works is you give away, first of all, you give away the new album when it's ready. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you can get a Naked Lady guitar. You can get a private concert.
You actually can get a Naked Lady guitar?
Yeah. Hmm.
It's a pretty neat guitar. So, somebody said they saw you at Paul's Mall in 1972, and they're going to see you again at Payament. So there you go.
Yeah.
That's from Bob.
Down on the Cape.
Yeah.
Do you mind playing old stuff, by the way? When people yell out, and I've heard it happen at your concerts, when they ask you to play something you played, what, 30,000 times or so? Does that bother you or do you love it?
Not a bit. People come to the show to hear what they know. And I feel antsy a little bit about doing so many new songs.
Yeah.
Because they didn't come to hear that. They like them once they've heard them, but they came to hear this, that, and the other one that they know from years ago. So I do a mix. And if somebody asks for a song, if I can do it, I will. Some of them are lost in the mists of time. But
You told that Joni Mitchell story all the time about being asked to sing. What was she?
I told
to
it the other day to Richard
again?
Ordner. I said on the radio, you might have heard that when I saw her at Radio City Music Hall, I heard this on one of her albums too, so I guess that happened a lot. Someone screams out, Play a Case of You, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful songs maybe ever done. And she says something like, hey, and not in a hostile way, no one ever asked Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night again, man. And so my sense was, that's why I asked you the question, actually.
Not that I'm comparing myself to Van Gogh or anything.
But I think she said it in a good spirit. I think she said it to be funny, but I really don't know. But I'm assuming, everybody remembers when we were kids. What's the name of, what's his face? The Garden Party, that old song, Ricky Nelson, writing about how much he hated those, what were those shows called when people from that era, those sort of, revival shows, John Sanrio, but they did the only oldies kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in those settings, people don't want to hear anything else. I think his song was talking about how they were actually booing or some such thing when they're playing their, that's sick to me.
Oh, come on. Who doesn't, how many times have you gone to a Bruce Springsteen concert? You're a big fan. He always plays Thunder Road. That was like one of his first songs, right?
One of my best, my favorite Bruce Springsteen quotes, somebody was saying, talking to him and saying, on stage you're just so alive and so vibrant and so, and he said, I wish I was that guy. I'm not. On stage, I am. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm not.
Well, it looks like to me like he's spent like 2 hours in the gym for 6 months before every concert because, you know, he's bopping around
like
crazy.
Well, when he's not on a 400-foot yacht with Barack Obama, he's at the gym. Yeah,
well,
that's a whole other...
Yeah.
I love that bit where there's... You may have covered this already.
What's that? But
a petition circulating in France, 40,000 signatures... Oh. People wanted Barack Obama to run for president.
No, I didn't know that.
Of France, on the argument that the two candidates they've got suck, and he has nothing else to do.
Well, you know, he just endorsed in a little video. He endorsed Macron, if that's how you pronounce it, the non-Le Pen candidate. So, can you do one more on?
Sure.
Before you say goodbye,
I think we should get back to politics. I think people are you're picking on Trump too much. I mean,
I think you are, Marjorie. Yes,
he's really,
because I know you're a big fan of his.
I sent out this email newsletter occasionally, and the last one just went out a couple of days ago. At the end, I put in a P.S. I think, you know, this business of re-examining the national monuments that just doesn't go far enough, and I think we should open up Central Park to logging.
And, why not?
And you know, I think a drilling rig would look good on the National Mall. And I got all kinds of response to that. And so there's a song that was written by, I've never done this before on the radio, but it was written by a friend of mine named Josh Brackett, and I think it explains the problems that we're having.
We're ready.
If I can remember it, because I haven't done it a lot. Damn. I'll tell you what's wrong with America. Tell you why times are so tough. The poor have too much money, and the rich don't have enough. I saw it on TV. A man came on the screen. He looked real cute in his new blue suit. He had the friendliest smile I've ever seen. He said, I'll speak to you tonight. From the bottom of my heart, it's a brand new day in the USA, and we all gotta do our part. And I'll tell you what's wrong with America. Tell you why times are so tough. The poor have too much money, and the rich don't have enough. I'm gonna try to get you to sing along. So I ask you if you're poor, call this 800 number today. Make a pledge to help the rich. Use your MasterCard or Visa to pay. You all gotta get on board for the transfer of wealth from the homeless and the welfare moms to buy the B2 stealth. And I'll tell you what's wrong with America. Tell you why times are so tough. Times are tough. The poor have too much money, and the rich don't have enough. So we'll cut the programs out, downsize the companies, roll up that safety net, send the best jobs overseas. And as I look down the road, I see America standing tall when the poor all have nothing, and the rich, they have it all. Everybody, I'll tell you what's wrong with America. Tell you why times are so tough. The poor have too much money, and the rich don't have enough. The poor have too much money, and the rich don't have enough.
Tom Rush.
Thank you
go
very,
to tomrush.com. He's got concerts coming up in Massachusetts, in New England, all throughout. Tom, it is great to see you.
Thank you
so much for coming in.
Very much appreciate
it.
Tom Rush,
you.
As you
Good
well
luck
know,
with the new album too.
Is a musician and a fantastic singer-songwriter and the love of Jim's life.
If you want to know what his
next album is, that's up to you, because he is crowdfunding it. But to do your part, as Jim just said, go to tomrush.com to learn more. Thank you again for coming out. It's a big thrill. Coming up next, Fred Wiseman. It's been 50 years since he made his famous and groundbreaking documentary, Tittecott Follies. He is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We are broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us is someone who no doubt can appreciate the civic space, the great and groundbreaking filmmaker Fred Wiseman. His forthcoming documentary is called Ex Libris, New York Public Library. Maybe the sequel will be Ex Libris, Boston Public Library. Fred Wiseman will be in conversation with Ty Burr from The Globe tonight over at GBH. Sadly, the event is sold out, but you can catch it on Facebook Live from 6 to 6:30. Fred Wiseman, it's an honor to meet you. Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate
Thank you for asking me.
Great to meet you and have you come in here. And it is the 50th anniversary of Titicut Follies,
right,
which is so well known by almost everybody. But just in case people don't know, give us, tell us what you did with Titicut Follies. What did you do?
Well, Titicut Follies is a documentary film about the Bridgewater prison for the criminally insane in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. It was shot in the spring of 1966 and released in 1967. And I had the run of the place to make the movie, and had permission from the superintendent and the commissioner of correction and the lieutenant governor and the attorney general. And when the movie was released, the Elliot Richardson, who at the time he got me permission to make the film, was the lieutenant governor to whom the commissioner of corrections reported. The following year was the attorney general. And Richardson, I think, was interested in running for Senate or governor, and he thought his political career would be damaged when it came out that he'd helped me get permission to make the film, because the film was received as being critical of the state of Massachusetts for allowing a place like Bridgewater to exist. And instead of supporting the film, a film that he liked, he, to protect his own career, or what he thought was necessary to protect his own career, he proceeded to get a temporary restraining order and brought suit against the film. And it ended up being banned for 23 years.
And what was the argument?
Years.
Was the argument that, was it a right to privacy argument? Was that what they prevailed upon?
That's what they prevailed on. But the real issue was political, that Richardson thought his career would be damaged. The specific grounds in which the lawsuit was brought was that it was an invasion of privacy of a man named Jim, who had been kept naked in his cell for 17 years, and he is shown naked in his cell, and he's seen taunted and struck by the guards as they lead him out of the cell to shave him. But before the film, there was no right of privacy in Massachusetts. Mm. The right of privacy only exists by statute or common law tradition, and it was found to exist for the first time in the Follies case. And the other grounds for going against the film was that I allegedly had made an oral contract giving the commissioner of correction, the superintendent, and the attorney general editorial control over the film. And as far as I know, neither of those three distinguished public servants were film editors. So it was simply they made up as a way of trying to prevent the defense of the film being made on First Amendment grounds. And it was a way of preventing the film, the case from being heard in the federal court.
We're talking to Fred Wiseman, and we're talking right now about Titicut Follies. You mentioned the gentleman being kept naked in his cell for 17 years, but it was an indictment of the prison there for the criminally insane. So tell people what else you discovered when you were filming, which I can't even believe you ever got permission to film, and I don't think you could get it today. But tell people what you discovered when you were filming there.
Well, what I discovered was 900 people, roughly 900 people, were housed in a prison in a building that had been built either just before or during the Civil War. The heating conditions were terrible. But more particularly, the staff was poorly trained. For example, at the trial, the chief psychiatrist there was asked what books he'd read, if any, in the field of psychiatry, and the only book he could remember reading was a book on dementia praecox, which was published in 1918.
Oh my gosh.
The The guards were poorly paid and poorly trained. There were hardly any recreational facilities. There was no therapy to speak of. Once people were sent there, they were basically, unless they had good representation, they were there for life. For example, there's one man in the film who was picked up in 1927 because he painted a horse to look like a zebra as a gimmick for selling ice cream in Falmouth. And he was picked up for vagrancy. And I met him in Bridgewater 40 years later. He's the kind of person, I thought it was rather enterprising to paint a horse to look like a zebra. He could have been an early forerunner of Baskin and Robbins. But if he'd had adequate representation, he'd never be there. Mixed up with people like that were people who'd done some of the most horrible crimes imaginable. But nobody was really being well taken care of. They were just warehoused.
Fred Wiseman, I've seen Teddy God Follies a number of times, like I'm guessing a lot of people have. When you read the newspaper and see 45 years after you made this, that Joshua Messier is killed, a prisoner there, or dies in the custody of poorly trained, correctional officers. And Charlie Baker, 50 years later, the governor of the Commonwealth, is talking about its successor, at least its name, Bridgewater State Hospital, and we have to reform it so there's more humane treatment of people there. What do you say to yourself a half century after?
Well, what I say to myself is I hope that the people who are currently, there's a new group that's been put in charge of the psychiatric and medical services there, and I hope, I met some of them at a meeting the other night, and they seem people of goodwill, and they're well-trained, but given the fact that it's taken 50
exactly.
years to reach this point, I can't help but be skeptical of the obstacles that may be placed in their way.
You know, Fred Wise, I've seen a lot of your films, and I asked Tom Rush this a minute ago. I think he was offended, so I'll offend you too. Why are you still doing what you do?
Oh, I do it because it's fun.
Is it fun?
Yeah, it passes the time. I have a good time doing it. I mean, I enjoy doing it, and I don't do it because I think there's going to be any great social effect, because the Follies disabused me of that notion. But I do it because I enjoy doing it, and it's interesting, and I get to travel, see the world, meet a lot of... I'm put in a lot of interesting situations and meet a lot of people I wouldn't otherwise contact with.
I'm almost nervous to ask this question since I don't know anything about film except what I like, and you are a master. Virtually everything I've ever seen of yours, it's almost like the camera is not there, and I'm amazed by how it seems to capture life exactly as it is. I know that's your intention, but there are a lot of documentarians for whom that is their intention, where I'm watching it and I say, there's a performance in that. There's something for the camera. That's obviously part of your goal. Why are you so successful at that where others, at least in my estimation, are not?
I think it's because people are distracted by my big ears.
And
they don't look in the camera. I don't know. I mean, the answer is I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, I can only speak from my own experience in my own movies. I don't think people act for the camera. And I think I say that because people don't have the capacity to suddenly become different. If they don't want their picture taken, they thumb their nose or they walk away. But if they agree to have their picture taken, they act in ways that they think are appropriate for the situation they're in.
You know, Fred Wiseman, you have been making films for a very, very long time. And besides Teddy God Follies, you looked at welfare and public housing and things that are tough. And I guess when you said you didn't do things, you didn't do them to change things. I mean, you think the average person would look at some of your work and be very upset by the conditions that people are living in and want something to change. So have things changed? Well, maybe not because of your films necessarily, but because you played a part in that and made people a little bit more concerned about humane treatment?
Well, I think, I certainly hope that's the case, but there's no way I can measure that. And all I'm, when the previous statement, all I'm really saying is that there's no way, I think it would be pretentious of me to say there's any kind of one-to-one relationship between what I do or what anybody else does by way of making movies and social change. I hope the films contribute to people's knowledge, to their capacity to make decisions that will be helpful to people that need assistance from the state.
Is that part of your mindset going into these settings, though? Or
well, I mean, my mindset, to the extent my mind is set, is that I want to make as good a film as I can about the subject that I'm working on. And I don't, when I start off, I don't have any thesis or point of view. I discover that as a consequence of being at a place for anywhere from a month to 12 weeks, and then spending a year studying the material. And the final film, in one sense, is a report on what I've learned as a consequence of the experience.
So you did the film during the Vietnam War, Basic Training. Tell people what you learned from that experience.
Well,
and the draft was going on, obviously, during Vietnam.
Well, it was just toward the end of the draft. And the Army had made basic training somewhat
easier. And you were in the Army.
I was in the Army 20 years before, maybe 18 years before. But in response to the protests against the war in Vietnam, basic training had become easier because there had been some mothers in America that had protested that their boys were being sworn at by drill sergeants.
God forbid.
So basic training was actually easier than I remembered it. I guess the thing I learned the most was what I had also been reminded of when I went through basic training myself, and that is how easy it is to turn a civilian into a soldier who's a killer. That the Army, it's a form of education which all armies are very skilled at, and that is to strip away the veneer of civility and make it acceptable for people to kill other people.
And what did you learn about welfare?
What did I learn about? The real answer to that question is what you see in the film. But I guess one thing that I may have learned is that don't accept any cliches about who's on welfare, because I think that the dominant cliche in 1973 when I made the film was that it was blacks that were on welfare. And I made the film in New York City, and you see that there are people of all races, sizes, genders, ethnicities on welfare, and that it's in no way restricted to one race or one ethnic group.
Now, Fred Wiseman, there's some good news and bad news. The good news for fans of yours, or would-be fans of yours, is a retrospective of your work at the MFA through June 4th called Frederick Wiseman for the Record. Here's the bad news, a little bitch from me. Whenever I'm in a Fred Wiseman state of mind, I go to Netflix forgetting almost nothing of yours. Am I right about this? Nothing of yours is on
about,
Netflix.
Netflix has, none of them are streamed. Netflix has, I think, 6 or 7 DVDs, but they're all available for my company, Zipporah Films, says he, making a plug.
Well, that's fine, and there's a website for that, too. Zipporah, correct?
Right, and I hope in the next 6 months they'll all be available, they'll all be streamed from the Zipporah Films website.
So it isn't like you have some objection to doing that, it just hasn't been done.
No. I mean, Netflix hasn't bought them. That's the only reason they're not on
they're
it.
They're making a big mistake.
Yeah. So tell us about this Ex Libris at the New York City Public Library. Maybe we can think about the Ex Libris at the Boston Public Library. What are you doing? What did you do
with
that?
It's a film I shot at the New York Public Library last year, which is going to open theatrically in September, and it'll be at I think it's going to be at the Museum of Fine Arts here at the end of September, beginning of October. I hung around the New York Public Library for 3 months, and the New York Public Library has the main building on 42nd Street, but there are 90 branches, some specialized like the Library for the Performing Arts or the Library for Black History and Culture, And what the movie is a portrait of the different activities of the library, with particular emphasis on how the branches have become community centers. And they offer after-school learning programs, enrichment programs. They teach English to recent immigrants. They have programs that tell people how to set up a corporation. They have enormous, New York Public Library, as I'm sure the Boston Public Library does, has enormous reach into the community. And the library is probably the greatest example of a democratic institution because it's open to everybody all the time. And that's what the film's about.
Do they have a hip and trendy radio studio like we do here?
No.
They
no.
Not.
Well, when you look at other people that might be doing what you have done, no one comes to my mind. Are there any documentary makers?
Well, everybody works in different ways.
Yeah.
And has different interests. I mean, there's a great documentary filmmaker who unfortunately isn't working much anymore by the name of Marcel Ophuls, who made two of the best movies ever made.
What?
One called The Sorrow and the Pity, about the French collaboration with the Germans during World War II, and another one called Hotel Terminus, which is about Klaus Barbie, who's a Gestapo chief in Lyon during the war. I don't think the way I work is necessarily the only or the right way to work. It's the way I like to work, and there are plenty of other good documentaries.
But I'm thinking of who's looking at public housing in 2017, or who's looking at some of those issues that you really do impact people that don't have any money.
Well, that I can't tell you because I don't know.
Okay.
Has there ever been anything that you were dying to do that you couldn't quite figure out how to get from here to there, either because of a lack of permission or because you couldn't conceptualize how you would do what you wanted to do?
No, I always deceive myself into thinking I can conceptualize it. But, you know, I haven't got permission for the White House yet.
Have you sought it? I didn't think so. You know, before you go, Fred Wiseman, can I do one of my...
I don't think he's going to get permission from the White House.
When I asked you before about how I think I think as well as I've ever seen, make it seem like there's no camera there. One of my obsessions is cameras in the courtroom. And one of the primary arguments, I don't know if you have an opinion about that, but as you know, state courts have them almost universally. Federal courts have them other than experiments, not at all. The Supreme Court of the United States says they're worried that lawyers' behavior would be affected, maybe even jurist behavior would be affected because of the presence of these minuscule cameras as they are in 2017. Do you have any reaction to this resistance to allow the world into courtrooms where cases are brought in our name?
No, all institutions in a democratic society are supposed to be transparent. The courts are obviously one of the key institutions, and I think both the courts and the public would benefit if the variety of activities that went on in courts was available to be seen and heard.
After Ex Libris, Supreme Court of the United States, Fred Wiseman, that would be my recommendation.
Okay, you get me permission, I'll start tomorrow.
I had a feeling you would. Fred, it's an honor to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Being
thank
here.
So
Fred Wiseman is, of course, an award-winning filmmaker. This year marks the 50th anniversary of his groundbreaking documentary, Tinnicott Follies, the forthcoming documentary, as we just said, Ex Libris, New York Public Library. Tonight, from 6 to 6:30 on Facebook Live, you can participate in an evening with Fred Wiseman. Just go to WGBH's Facebook page. And if you want to have a Fred Wiseman full immersion experience, you go to his production and distribution company. I'm going to spell it. It's Sepora Films at Sepora.com, but that's spelled ZIPPORAH.com. Fred Wiseman, thank you again for coming in. Appreciate
thank you.
It. Up next, a bridge to nowhere. Where did the ride-hailing bus service bail out on Boston? Or why, I should say, did it bail out on Boston? WGBH contributor and Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. And we are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Is it Boston Public Radio or is it Boston? It's Boston Public Radio. That's right. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for our Friday news quiz. For that, we're joined by Kim Klausner and Chloe Alice Lynn. They're co-starring in Peerless, an adaptation of Macbeth. The production, this is pretty exciting, is a collaboration between Company One and the Boston Public Library. It's being performed right here at the BPL in Rabb Hall through May 28th. Chloe and Kim, it is a pleasure to meet you both. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Now, before we even start, though, Kim, you had an incredibly insightful comment when I met you a minute ago. I'd like you to share it, if you would. It was very deep and thoughtful. Share it with Marjorie, please.
Sure. All of my friends are super excited for me to be here. They're big fans. My mother-in-law especially. Hello, Marie.
Oh. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Marie.
But all of my friends are big fans, so real excited.
Oh, that makes us very happy. So I think this is one of the great ideas for a play of all time, because everybody's become basket cases over getting into college. So tell us, what's the plot here, Chloe?
Oh, my God. Kim is really good at...
Kim, what's the plot?
Okay. Well, the plot of Peerless, it centers around two twin girls.
You two.
Yes, us. We play the twins.
Who's L and who's M?
I'm L. I'm Chloe. I'm L.
And you're M.
And yes, I'm okay. M. They are set on going to what they refer to as the college throughout the play. It's never mentioned, but obviously it's Ivy League, well-known college. And they've planned... their lives such to a T that they are, there's no doubt in their mind they're going to get it. However, something happens and their plan doesn't go, I guess, as planned. And so because of that, they take extremes to get what they feel they deserve.
You know, the description I've read in more than one place, so I assume it comes from your end rather than a reporter or a critic, is Macbeth meets Mean Girls. Is that a fair? Is that a fair description?
That's very fair.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, definitely.
You
are. Definitely.
Did you guys know each other before?
We met 3 years ago, a very long time ago. But then we got reconnected when we saw each other auditions.
At auditions, I thought I met my energetic twin.
So is this, would you call it, I know I've read it's a comedy turned thriller, comedy turned horror story. Is that kind of what it is?
Definitely. Yeah. It's, I think, a really great way, which is what Jihei, the playwright, says, it's funny until it's not.
Yeah.
She does a really great way of writing where you laugh at things and then you think, wait, should I have laughed at that? Was that okay? Yeah. And I think that's one of the great aspects about this work.
So did this come from the playwright's own horrid experience getting into college? Where did this come from?
I think I read an interview about that, and I think it did come from her own background, her experience, but also it just came from her imagination.
Yeah.
I think it came from once, I think in the interview she said she was working on another play and she was having writer's block and she started writing this. And it just flowed so easily. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's
You know, Tori Bedford, our colleague, saw it and loved it, by the way. And the reviews have been absolutely fabulous. Is there a little piece I read about? I love this because I am obsessed with this topic, by the way, and appalled by it. I don't mean the play. I mean the whole concept of this cutthroat competition. Yeah. That you guys moved to a Midwestern suburb specifically to get a geographical edge in admission.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes. The twins, they moved to an unknown Midwestern town. One of them stays back a year, so they have sibling preference in terms of getting into college. I mean, they go to extremes. It's pretty impressive, but also extremely scary.
How's doing it in this bill? How's doing it in Rabb Hall? I mean, it is really exciting. I wasn't aware it was here until a couple of days ago. What's that like, Chloe? Is that as a venue?
It is so sacred. The library.
Exactly.
The Boston Public Library. And we're here. And the hall is amazing. I've never seen it before. Now I've seen it many, many times.
They haven't done a play. If they've done a play, they had this first play.
First play.
Which is awesome.
Inaugural.
So cool.
Yeah.
So one last thing before we start the quiz. Are the parents implicated here for producing these two ruthless twins? or is it just that the twins are sociopaths or something? What's the deal?
Well, there are no adults in this play.
It was it's mentioned very, very subtly.
Yeah.
We had to come up with our own backstory for the mother.
Yeah. Okay. During pre-workshops.
But it's not mentioned.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So do you think this is mom's fault or the kids just sociopaths?
I think it's society.
It's society. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's certainly true.
Okay. You want to do the quiz, you two?
Okay.
You have no choice. Actually, it was a stupid question. Who do you want to start with,
Marjorie? Usually I say girl, boy, but since you're both female,
you are, they
why don't
I
start with Kim? We'll do closer to me this time. Okay, ready?
Yes.
Sometimes President Trump takes the whole 2.0 thing too literally.
This morning, Donald Trump suggested the U.S. needs a good shutdown to fix I don't think Donald Trump realizes that the is not like a computer. You can't fix it by just turning it off and back on again.
Okay, do you know what the president suggested shutting down?
I know that they just halted the shutdown because they approved the spending.
Yeah, what was the shutdown of?
Do you know? Wait,
they're twins. They can do it.
I don't know specifically.
Okay.
What are you saying? I mean, so
she just told you.
The government? Did you say the government?
Yeah.
That's fine. Ding, 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 ding.
Chloe, that was very nice of you. You see, you never would have gotten into a good college if you behaved that way, telling your friends the answers
to
the test.
I think you got a point for that. I'm not quite clear. Okay. Here's your opportunity. Well, thank you very much, whatever that was. Chloe, you can tie this thing up. President Trump might not need to brush up on his Shakespeare, speaking of Macbeth, but he could brush up on U.S. history.
Trump questioned why America had a civil war and suggested that could have prevented it, even though died 16 years before the civil war started. Incidentally, 50 years from now, the name Donald Trump is going to be the answer to the question, why was there a second civil war?
Who did Donald Trump say could have prevented a civil war? Which president could have prevented a second civil war? It's his hero. It's the guy he compares himself to a lot of.
Andrew Jackson.
That is exactly right. With no help from your alleged twin here. So the score is sort of 1-1 at the end of one round. Marjorie, take it away.
Okay.
Oh, yes, you are.
Oh, no.
Okay. Trump has been spending a lot of time outside the White House. Here's Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, I saw that Trump defended all his trips that he's made to his saying he only goes there to hold meetings. Even guys who go to Hooters for the wings were like, yeah, right.
Okay, where has Trump been conducting a lot of his business on the weekends?
Mar-a-Lago?
No. I think we have to give the answer. The answer we have is golf courses, but Mar-a-Lago is part of the deal. It is 2-1, even though both of your points have been fairly sketchy, I should say there, Kim, if I may. Chloe, you can tie this thing up. You ready?
Yes.
President Trump has caused, we're talking to the two stars of Peerless, by the way, here at the Boston Public Library. It's there through May 28th. President Trump has caused some controversy this week by asking to meet with some unpopular foreign leaders. Here is Conan O'Brien. Chloe looks confident.
Yes. President Trump also said he would be honored to meet Trump said he's my kind of guy. He's crazy, he's overweight, and he has a ridiculous haircut. We should get together. It's time.
Who did Donald Trump say he would be, quote, honored to meet, Chloe?
Kim Jong Un.
That is exactly
very
correct.
Good. That was said.
How much have you guys done? I don't mean together, because I know you just mentioned your meet. How much have you done before this play? How much of a career have you had prior to Peerless, Chloe?
Just here, like, spottedly.
What does that mean, spottedly?
In Boston, like, here and there, it's really rare to have a play like this with two Asian actors come by. So, like, spottedly. I've done a lot of theater in China.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you have? Where in China? And what kind of
Beijing.
Theater? Oh, you have?
Like, the same kind, but in my own language, my native tongue, which is Mandarin. This is like the comeback play for me because I haven't done theater in 3 years.
That's great. How about you, Kim?
I've done a little bit of theater, mostly just in Boston Fringe Theater, the scene there.
I love the word spottedly. I didn't even know that was a word, but that is perfect.
Chloe, did you go to high school in the United States?
Yeah.
And Kim, you went to high school in the United States?
I did. I'm local.
Okay, so how representative of this play? I mean, not the nasty and plotting and Macbeth part, but of the rat race that you experienced
you see the look
in
on
your
Kim's
junior
face.
Or senior year in high school. Very, very similar, Kim. How so?
Yes. I think it's just the pressure that you feel from your family, from your friends, from society. It's not even just like getting into college, but everything is such high stakes when you're in high school.
Yeah.
Everything, it just, it's so weighted. Everything carries such a weight. So I think that the play definitely reflects how I felt in high school.
You know what I also thought too, and it's tough because, you know, you want your children to go out and do good things because they want to do good things, but then it becomes like a little resume thing to check off. Like, oh, you know, I went down to the homeless shelter. Or, there's a certain cynicism about that it's kind of too bad. I don't know what you do about it, but it's real.
You go see Peerless is what you do. Now, the third round question goes to Kim from you, Marjorie.
Okay. Am I on?
A government official.
Thank you. A government official was looking a little green this week while testifying in front of Congress. Here's Conan O'Brien.
Testified before Congress today and said that it makes him mildly nauseous to think that his actions might have affected the election. Of course, that might just be from all that time he spent looking at Anthony Weiner's laptop.
Okay. Do you know who testified before Congress this week?
James Comey.
You are correct. Yes. That was excellent, Kim. Okay.
That was an answer with a question involved. Yeah. Here's the last one in the regular round here. First, there was the light bulb, the transistor, the iPhone, and now McDonald's has added a new addition to the pantheon of great American inventions.
As part of a limited campaign, McDonald's is offering forks made from Not to be outdone today, Long John Silver's began offering seafood made from fish.
I didn't know this. What are McDonald's new forks made out of? Do you know?
I'm going to take a guess and say fries.
How do you know that?
Oh, my God. That was like a guess.
That is
great. Oh, my God. It's right.
That was a really good guess.
You know, that I don't know how that works.
What is that?
It's a little greasy.
Eat it. But like, not just greasy. They've got to be really hard french fries.
How great
right?
you can eat the fork. I mean,
it's great.
Does it get any better than that?
No, it's great after it's all done, but I have to go check this out.
I worry about its functionality.
And how do they get the prongs?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm very disturbed by this, Jim. I have to do some investigative reporting. Okay, now we're going to move on to the bonus round.
Okay, Margaret, do your disclaimer, which
I always
I can't
say this.
Stand.
These are like very difficult questions, but they're multiple choice.
Oh my
and
God.
Most people get them wrong, so don't worry if you do.
So here's the deal. In honor of our guest this week, and that would be you two, who are from the production of Peerless, an adaption of Macbeth, our bonus round will test their knowledge of other adaptions of the Scottish play. Mm-hmm. Here is, you want to ask Chloe first, Margaret.
Okay, here we go, Chloe.
All
we
right.
always switch up in the bonus round. A 1930s film adaptation of Macbeth is set in an undisclosed American criminal underworld. What is the name of the main character? Salvador D'Amica, Joe Macbeth, or Machine Gun Billy.
This is real, by the way. This is not made up.
I know what I want it to be.
Machine Gun Billy.
That is a great guess.
Oh,
unfortunately.
So
sad. I get that. That is not correct.
So sad.
Kim, you want to take a try?
Is it the first one?
That is equally sad.
Is it Joe Macbeth?
Yes,
apparently
Joe Macbeth. Wasn't very subtle, I guess,
okay.
was it?
No.
Okay. Now, Kim, you can move into a one-point lead with only two questions to go. In 1936, in New York City... By the way, Jerry, have you ever seen Macbeth? Like, have you before this?
Yes.
You have. Have you seen Macbeth?
The play, you mean?
As in the play. Yes, the play.
Yes.
Oh, you have.
It's very upbeat.
Before you were hired
very
to
upbeat.
Do this? Or
yes,
once
in high
you
school.
Oh, you had.
High school.
You
yeah.
too?
Everyone does it in
you're
high
okay,
school.
Okay,
you got to see it.
In 1936, a New York City stage production of Macbeth had the story take place on a fictional Caribbean island with an entirely African-American cast. Who was the director? A, Orson Welles. B, Alfred Hitchcock. Or C, John Ford. And while this will not help you at all, a little side factoid, the person of those three incredibly famous directors who it actually was 20 years old at the time. Was it Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock, or John Ford?
I want to say it was either like Hitchcock or Welles, but...
So what are you going to say?
I'm going to say Hitchcock, because that's like crazy.
That is an excellent answer, but an incorrect answer. So it is either, apparently there, Chloe, it is either Orson Welles or John Ford.
It's Orson Welles because I Wikipedia'd this.
Dang
why?
It. I don't know. When I was researching this play, I somehow stumbled upon this
that
fact.
Is very impressive.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, what, can I explain what's going on here? This is very
certainly.
High drama.
High drama, you're right. Okay.
You are, whose question is this? Is this Chloe's question?
Yes. Oh.
Okay, you are up by 1 point. Mm-hmm. We're going to change the rules. If you get it right, you win. That is not
oh
a rule
God.
Change. If you get it wrong, She wins. She wins. Now, that's not really fair, but it will excite the fans.
It's dramatic. Yes.
Okay, let's do it.
High stakes.
Okay, here we go, Chloe. In a modern twist, the 2001 film Scotland, PA takes place where? Dunsinane Regional High School. Did I pronounce that right?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it did, actually.
Ladies Nail Salon or Duncan's Cafe, a fast food restaurant?
Take your time.
I feel like it's A. Dunson.
Oh, wait a second. I'm changing the rules.
What?
No, I'm changing the rules again. For you to win, you actually have to get it right, Kim.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't comfortable with my arbitrary decision.
It was a nail salon, and then what was the other option?
Fast food restaurant. Duncan's Cafe.
Duncan's Cafe.
Ladies Nail Salon or Duncan's Cafe?
I'm going to say it is at the cafe.
You are
Congratulations.
Correct. There you go.
Boy, you are really into this, aren't you?
I'm extremely competitive, too.
We noticed, actually. I don't think we needed you to tell us.
You're perfect for this role, then, right?
Yeah.
You're just playing yourself.
How's this experience been for you, too? I mean, it's really great to get great reviews, I assume. That's a pretty nice thing. But apart from people praising your work and the writing and the whole production, how has this been for you, too? How's this been? I mean, people can't see you. You're young actors. And as you say, how's it been?
I think it's been great.
Why are you looking at her and asking a question?
I feel like this whole experience has been. I love the cast, but Chloe and I don't know. We have this like crazy bond now. So I always do. Yeah. I always go to her even when we're not in the play. I'm like, oh, what do you feel?
That's pretty great, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, this whole experience, like working with the Boston Public Library, working with Company One, working with Chloe and the cast and the team has just been fantastic.
It's been a very professional just experience. Mm-hmm. It's really nice.
Yeah,
good.
It's a thrill to meet both of you.
Well, thank you both for coming in.
And
congratulations on
your
fine work. Kim Klassner and Chloe Alice Lynn are co-starring in Peerless. It's an adaptation of Macbeth. The production is a collaboration between Company One and the Boston Public Library, and it's being performed right here at the Boston Public Library in Rapp Hall through May 28th. Kim and Chloe, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations again. And thank you all for listening to another...
By the way, can I interrupt and say what I'm going to do,
what?
Because I'm so fond of you, I'm going to drive by your house to make sure you're okay this weekend in light of the vote in the House of Representatives yesterday.
I'm very upset.
I'll just honk my horn every few hours
very
and you go to the window and wave to make
conditions.
Sure you're okay.
Okay, thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in on Monday. We've got Charlie Sennett. We're going to go over the results of the French election. Our TV guy...
Oh, Sunday, that's right.
Yes, our TV guy Bob Thompson also joins us. Barack Obama endorsed the guy with the wife who's 23 years older than he is, or 24 years older. I love that.
Shocked that you noticed that.
Anyway, I did notice that right away. We're going to also talk politics with Michael Curry and Jennifer Becerra. So I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Jim Browdy is not on television tonight.
I'm not.
But Emily Rooney is. Beat the Press, 7 o'clock. Don't miss it.
Do you want to thank people for coming?
I do.
Thank you all for coming. We really appreciate you being
everybody
here.
Everybody that took the time to come down here. It really is wonderful.
Thanks to the Newsfeed Cafe. We love this place.
I hope you love Tom Rush. He was wonderful. Everybody's wonderful today.
And we'll be back on Tuesday. Tuesday here. Back
That's
in
right.
Brighton.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. As I said, please tune in again on Monday and have a wonderful weekend. And thanks to the crowd at the Boston Public Library.